If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Hey, kids, him and her on the radio. And this was a much better drive than it was a week ago.
It was actually delightful. We only experienced rain when we got closer to downtown.
Yeah.
And it was just a little spitting rain, spittle. And compared to last, I said to you at one point, I said, why does last Saturday feel like it was a year ago?
Because last Saturday driving in was a year.
Yes, that's right. It felt
all
like
all by itself.
Yep, yep. I'm with you. Wow. Well, we're glad to be here. It's kind of quiet in the studio because it's just us kids here.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the first times in I don't know how long that we don't have an in-studio guest, but we've got a ton of interesting people we're going to be talking to tonight.
Yeah.
And it's going to be one of those shows because the thought that I was about to share, which was one of the best thoughts that I had ever decided to present, it just walked out of my head.
It was material for the Museum of Broadcasting.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's just slipped right through that hole in your head.
Yes.
One ear, not the other, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's going to... You know what? You've got coffee. You haven't had any coffee today. You've got to have your coffee.
That's the problem.
Yes. Yep. You've gone all day.
When we came into the garage, we were amazed.
Yeah.
We had no problems parking. We were... Because usually when there's Lollapalooza or something going on, oh boy, are there problems parking in the garage.
We have that white knuckle experience when the garage door is open. You're like, oh, I hope there's a space when we get in there.
But while I was watching the garage doors open, you were watching a fee person who was walking and who apparently had come from Lala.
And they were just wearing their underpants.
You can tell if they've just been to Lala or they're going. You definitely can.
Yes.
Yep.
I mean, literally, they had no pants on. They had underwear, just panties. That's it. I went, oh, that's a lot more than I thought I was going to see tonight. But yeah, that was kind of disturbing. But Bob, you said you left early because you were counting on a whole bunch of Lala traffic. And what happened?
I avoided it all.
But you got here an hour and a half early.
Yeah, an hour before my shift.
Yep. But, yeah.
You know. Which makes Krista happy, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I think really because everything was delayed, they still had huge crowds. But how did they get the word out that the opening was delayed by 2 hours and then it became 4 hours?
And are those acts that were supposed to be playing in that time period rescheduled or we'll never see them again?
They were both. They were rescheduled or had their sets cut short.
Yeah.
And I assume everybody heard the news on WGN Radio. We were reporting it all afternoon.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because we are your Lala headquarters.
Yeah. We had it every hour, every half hour.
I know.
Look, they've changed it. It's not 11 anymore. Now it's 2. Now it's 3.
So
I mean, you think of Lollygag, you think WGN.
And I think next week the big story will be how much it will cost the organizers to get the field back in order.
And I'm thinking minimum $1 million.
I think it was $1 million last year. That's my recollection.
I think you're right.
And it didn't rain.
I know, it was dry.
It was dry.
So, wow, what is this going to be like? But they go into it knowing that they're going to put the field back in its original place. And sometimes it looks better after they're done with it.
Jonathan, your trip into the station tonight?
Was quite surreal and a little bit jarring. Uh-oh. Like I told both of you when you arrived at the studio, the average age, I couldn't quite put a finger on because they all looked like babies. They all looked like children. And I had specifically told Steve that of the crowd that was on my train car, there's no way they could have switched two solid foods no more than 3 or 4 years ago. It was literally a train car full of ultrasounds.
This coming from the youngest person here.
Yes, it's true.
Wait, being ageist.
Wait, did you say a train car full of ultrasounds?
That's exactly what I said, because that's exactly what was there.
So they say the age is 18 to 24, because the meme floating around today is, yeah, if you're 25 or older, find something else to do this weekend. Well, you know, the music does appeal to some folks who are older than 24.
Yeah, yeah, those are the people in the reserve tents with, yeah, air conditioning and catering. Mm-hmm. And
drinking wine,
right,
you know, while everybody else is going, I need a glass of water. There's no water to be had.
Well, I do remember going to those concerts like B-Bash and Lala in the early 2000s, but I don't remember my generation looking that young. Like, they
you
look,
did.
If they are 18 yeah, years did. Old, I mean, maybe I'm dating myself here, but again, like, it's something that if they looked no more than 12 to 16.
Well, I'm also going to bet that you all wore pants 20 years ago.
I always thought that was a prerequisite. Like,
yeah, like silly us.
I think I'll wear pants today. No.
So as we were driving in tonight, Johnny and I were talking about, if you're given that 18 to 24, mm-hmm, is that the age bracket? What was the most impactful concert you saw, mm-hmm, when you were that age?
18 to 24.
And, yes, and immediately I thought, I don't have to think about that, Beatles, Comiskey Park.
Mm. Ooh, that's a really good one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the rest of us just kind of pale compared to the Beatles. Really? And it was Comiskey Park, too.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it wasn't the
And all I remember was...
Yes.
And little bits of sounds, maybe a little drums somewhere in the mix, and maybe, yeah, an occasional guitar.
Oh, golly.
So and I remember that John Lennon drove security nuts, because at the end of their set, the last number they did was Twist and Shout. And all of the Beatles are exiting to, I guess it's stage right, and he starts to run down toward the audience off stage left, and the security went nuts. And then he laughed and ran back and ran away.
Well, I guess there was some insanity last night when Youngblood took to the stage at Lollapalooza, because, first of all, he traveled to the park by train.
I love that.
By L train. And everybody said, seeing a picture of him, it was either Danny from Grease or it was Youngblood, yeah, because he was wearing a leather motorcycle jacket and it was warm, but he still looked really cool. And then after the show, he ended up at the Riviera and did a late night show, and that was absolute insanity. I've watched many videos of...
I like him on a lot of levels.
I do, too. I really do. I think he's doing a good job with music. He's writing some good music. He's been around more than Ozzy, kind of passing the whole business of their kind of music on to Youngblood. He'd been around for a good 10 years prior to Ozzy.
And obviously, I know nothing about his private life, but everything I've seen gives me the sense that this is a pretty good guy.
Yeah. Well, he brings his mother to shows, and I'm like, really? Okay. Kind of makes me love you a little bit more. So, all right, Bob, did you go to concerts when you were 18 to 24? Not your thing?
Nope.
No? Why am I not surprised? Yeah, I can see you not being very tolerant of that. Okay, Jonathan, 18 to 24, best concert experience that you recall.
I saw My Chemical Romance at the Aragon Ballroom.
Oh, I bet that was wonderful.
Oh, at the Aragon, no less.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic venue. And their stage show is amazing. They're just great performers and great showmen.
The last show I saw at the Aragon was Fog Hat. I remember my foot sticking to the floor, and I was like, I like these shoes. I need that shoe. I got to get my foot unstuck. Okay, Ron, 18 to 24, your best concert experience.
Oh, probably Bruce Springsteen at the Uptown Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
you
know. My gosh, at the Uptown.
At the Uptown.
Yeah,
wow.
At the Uptown.
Oh, get out. Boy, mine just kind of seems stupid.
I wound up waiting to him to come out to his bus afterwards and got an autographed ticket that I still have, too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Cool.
So that goes on your Springsteen altar at the house?
It does, indeed. Yeah, it's still there.
Do you recall how long the concert was?
No, I don't. I mean, it was just, I know that I was damp with sweat by the end of the the end of the evening. And we knew that once he started playing Rosalita, that the security around the stage backed off and you could, you know, kind of rush the stage, which is what we did every time. And so I was like elbows on the stage with Bruce Springsteen right up there, and saw all the encores that way, and it was quite the memorable experience.
I bet. At the Uptown, no less. Wow. As I say, mine pales because I immediately thought of seeing Three Dog Night, and I just thought that was, to me, it was a life-changing concert because they were so
wonderful.
Good. Yes.
Did you see them at the amphitheater?
I did, yes.
Because I saw, now this would have been 70s, and I saw three or four Three Dog Night concerts. That they were just one of the best live acts I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, outdoor concert, the best was Emerson, Lake & Palmer at Soldier Field. And we got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I don't think they came out till 8 o'clock that night. So my recollection is it was a good concert. It's all kind of a blur in retrospect.
But. Was that one of those big Super Bowl of rock things where there were like about eight or nine different bands, all big names?
Yep.
Yeah,
and my strongest memory, aside from excellent music, because it was really good at Soldier Field. I mean, the acoustics were quite good.
That's amazing for an outdoor venue.
But the guy that I was with, unbeknownst to me, brought along an official military gas mask. So when he smelled pot, he put it on, and I thought, oh, Lord.
Well, I thought you were going to say he smoked pot.
No. What? He stood up and, like, with his hands on his hips, like, people, what are you? I thought, who am I with? What is this all about? And he's wearing this scary military gas mask, and he wouldn't take it off. And I'm like, please, we look really stupid as people are, you know, they're outside. They're enjoying a joint. They've been there for 12 hours already. And he's like, no, we're not having any of that nonsense. Like, wow, now you're showing your true colors. I had no idea.
Is that before people of that ilk would have been designated a narc?
Probably, you know. That's probably why everybody steered clear of us. They thought if we get too close to them, we'll be busted.
But that reminds me of I will never forget, a funny conversation we had with Larry Schreiner when he went to, I forget why, but he went to the Grateful Dead concert at Soldier Field.
And for people who don't know, Larry Schreiner was, he was a special human being that worked the streets as a reporter.
But he had been a former policeman.
Yes. And he was the right hand of this radio station's news department. I mean, he was everywhere. And God bless him, he was odd.
If you can imagine, kind of Howard Nessman.
Yes. Yes, like a fish out of water.
WKRP.
Every place he went, driving a big old Mercedes and parking it outside places where he would have to pay people to protect his car.
And again, for people who are new to this part of our conversations, Larry Schreiner was a police reporter. Back in the day, he was supplying video footage to not one, but every single television station in Chicago. So if something happened at night, Larry would be there. He would take the footage, and he had videotape duplicators in the back seat of his car.
Oh, that big old Mercedes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he would just sit on ramps on the expressway, and people would drive up, couriers would, and would take a copy of
Channel 9, Channel 7, Channel 2, Channel 5.
And they would take a copy of the video with them. So it was a good gig. But that was back in the day when the camera that he carried on his shoulder was a big camera. And, you know, nowadays you just use your cell phone to take your video. All right, we've kind of rambled away there. That's how it happens on the show, but we have 5 hours to ramble, and we've got some great guests coming up tonight, so we hope that you will stay with us right here on WGN.
We should mention what is coming up on this radio station tonight, because we've got some interesting people we're going to talk to. Back in 1966, one of the biggest records of the year was I Fought the Law by Bobby Fuller. And when Bobby Fuller passed away, we'll talk about the specifics of that later, but there was never really any clear explanation of his death.
A 23-year-old guy who was on the cusp of big, big things happening for him.
So we're going to be talking with a guy who's done some research. His name is Ron Smith. and he has written a fascinating book called He Fought the Mob. So we're going to talk with Ron a little later.
You get it? He Fought the Mob. It gives you a little clue as to what might have happened to Bobby Fuller 60 years ago.
And this is the 100th anniversary of Rainbow Cone.
Mm-hmm. 100 years ago.
Are your salivary glands right now starting to say...
Well, I love pistachio ice cream, so I'm all over that. And the combination of the orange and the chocolate and the New York and the Palmer House. And well, anyway, we're going to talk about the fact that the Rainbow Cone has been around for 100 years.
Yeah, with David Hammond, who we've had on the show before. He is a journalist that writes a lot about food around Chicago. Also, there's something going on right now that is so cool. I think was last night the opening? Was Friday night the opening? Those of you who have been around Chicago for a long time, you know about the 400 Theater, a wonderful theater, north side.
A little gem up on the north side.
And sadly, it has been closed for too many years. It is reopening this weekend, and we're going to talk with the new owner about the 400 Theater.
They are showing Spider-Man to crowds standing outside waiting to get in to the new 400, which
I love this.
It's really exciting. Yeah. I'm so happy for him, too.
Also, later tonight, we're going to talk with the publisher of Consumer Guide, Tom Appel. Lots of things to share with you, including a personal experience that we want to share with you, an automotive experience, just a little tip, something that we tried and it worked out, and you might be able to do it whatever vehicle you happen to have.
Oh, I see what you're doing.
See?
I know.
That's called forced listening. See, you throw out the T's. You say,
if you want to know the answer,
Did you say we'd be giving away $1 million? Well, I did. I didn't say that, but, you know.
You better hush right now. We're going to take a break for news, get you all up to date news and weather. So stay with us right here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. Okay, for those of you who have your scorecards out, you know that usually when we use a little bit of a music bump, it has something to do with something we're going to talk about.
Yes.
Now, that music bump was Henry Mancini, Baby Elephant Walk. Why on earth would we be playing Baby Elephant Walk?
Because this is an anniversary for us.
And what does that have to do with baby elephants?
Well,
it was 36 years ago.
No, time out. 43 years.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. 43 years ago.
It just feels like 36 years ago, but it was 43 that we were the king and queen of King Richard's Fair. The Renaissance Fair up in Bristol, Wisconsin.
Which is now called the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Fair.
Goes on till Labor Day, but it was August 1st, 43 years ago, when we were dressed as the king and queen, which to me was heaven. I was just, I was so happy.
See, we were working at that point for another radio station, WIND, and they said, okay, you're going to do this promotion, you'll be the king and queen. Nobody told me we'd be getting dressed in period costumes.
Oh, I knew. I was so happy because I got to wear this.
How did you get that information and no one told me?
I said, will we be dressed appropriately or should I be buying an outfit for this event? And they said, oh, no, don't worry. We have great costumes. And I had this headpiece with this long chiffon trail and this corsety thing on and this long dress. And you, on the other hand, had on tights and a velvet tunic
and like a floppy hat.
It was a pimp beret,
but because nobody had told me, so I'm dressed in a period, you know, with the tunic and everything else and sunglasses and beetle boots.
It was quite the scene, but the fun part was hearing you in the dressing room going, how do you put these on? I don't know.
Literally, nobody told me till we got there, and they said, oh, now here's your dressing room. What?
Here are your tights, and here's your tunic. And
then
there's a theme here, no pants, because you had no pants. You were just wearing tights.
So then well, now, okay, we're dressed up. Now what do we do?
We're shaking hands and we're just enjoying the crowd. And
well, we want you to meet Killer. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Killer? Killer, the elephant that we were going to ride.
Oh, didn't we tell you you're going to be riding the elephant? Well, I got to ride side saddle, but Steve didn't.
Yeah.
Which the sounds he made in my ear were not, and we were broadcasting live, so we have a live microphone in hand as we were galloping through King Richard's Fair.
Yep.
And the man that was walking, quote unquote, Killer said, "Oh, watch this." And we started galloping and you were moaning in my ear. It was not a good sound. And then all I saw were turkey legs because people are eating turkey legs and they're flying in the air like, ah!
Because we're riding on top of this elephant running through these people and people are scattering like crazy.
Yes, yes. And as the elephant slowed down, you said to me.
When I wait.
Okay.
Because I said this during a commercial break.
Yes.
Because, and Johnny and I at that point, we'd been dating for a while. And it was starting to get serious. And I said something like, you know, if you want this to get more serious, there's a pretty reasonable probability that we should get off this elephant now.
Yeah, and I said, okay. Because I was perfectly happy riding a side saddle, and I looked fabulous with my big chiffon trailing behind me.
And then I proposed during the commercial break on an elephant.
With 60 seconds before we went back live, and I'm like, and my mother happened to be there and snapped the picture, not knowing that that was the very moment that you'd asked me to marry you. So I'm going to post the picture of us on Killer the Elephant, and I'm looking so smug and so happy because I love my outfit, and you, on the other hand, are wearing beetle boots and riding an elephant.
With sunglasses.
With sunglasses and beetle boots on. And an elephant is hairy. That's what you kept saying. There are hairy. It's hurting inside my legs. There's like bristly
Jonathan
hair.
Jonathan, ever ridden an elephant?
I've never ridden an elephant, but I have been to the Bristol Renaissance Fair.
Well, if anyone ever invites you to ride an elephant,
say no.
Politely decline.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
No. Yep.
Unless they say you can ride side saddle. And if that happens, then if there are other people around, they'll laugh you out of the joint because they said, sir, you have to ride like this. I'm like, okay, well.
So, and as I recall, you're riding side saddle.
Mm-hmm.
I think, behind you, not riding side saddle and holding a microphone.
Yes.
And trying to act very calm as Killer is loping along.
And what kind of device did we have between us so that we could broadcast?
Was that back in the days of Marty's?
It would have been a portable Marty.
A little Marty unit. So that
this would have been roughly.
What's a little 2 watts into your body? It's nothing.
This would
it's
have
like
been roughly
next to the microwave. No big deal.
Roughly 1983.
Yes. So we had equipment, and I mean a big stick microphone. When we were galloping, you were like, okay, when I get out of here, I could pummel the man that's walking, quote unquote, the elephant with this microphone, but it might get bloody. And I was thinking, you know, they'd probably love that at the Renaissance Fair. Oh, cool.
You'd get a couple of huzzas.
We got jousting with a microphone. So I just posted the picture of us on Killer. And as I said, 43 years ago today, we were the king and queen of King Richard's Fair. This pic was taken shortly after he popped the question. We were riding Killer the Elephant. By the way, she said yes. And my mom just happened to be there in the crowd. And,
I forgot that we had that little, that's almost like a fence thing that was kind of around us to keep us from sliding off Killer.
It may have been 43 years ago, but I can still remember the sounds you were making in my ear. And then when we went live, the consummate professional, you would not have guessed that you were in agony.
Literally, it was like, okay, 2 minute commercial break. You're going to propose?
Yes. You're going to say yes? Okay. We're back. Yeah. And we didn't say a word. We didn't tell anyone. We didn't tell our family. We didn't tell a soul. Because I wanted to see if, in fact, you would have survived the ride before I committed to the rest of the world that this is what was happening. And then it was, actually, that was August 1st. So it was really Christmas before everybody knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 43 years ago. Why did you initially say 36?
I have no idea.
It just feels like 36 years, not 43.
I knew there was a 3 in the in there
somewhere. It's all right.
Well, it was 83.
Yes.
So I got one number right.
Yes, yes, yes. You can text us throughout the night and go to our pictures too, because I posted pictures, our ride to work tonight, much different than last week's pictures and our drive to work. And the first picture you're going to see when you go to our Facebook page is the picture of us at King Richard's Fair on Killer the Elephant. And throughout the night, you can text us at 312-981-7200. We were talking about great concerts from the 18 to 24 age group. You were that age. What did you see that sticks with you today? A lot of folks are mentioning Poplar Creek.
Oh, sure.
That was a great place to go to concerts. Bob, did you ever work Poplar Creek?
Yeah, I broadcasted a couple of times.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, you know, the engineering community way back then... in Chicago, we don't compete with each other because, you know, we're not, you know, we're not in programming, you know, as they say, not responsible for programming content. So there was one guy in the market that had the equipment that would work at Poplar Creek. Only one.
Oh, wow.
So when you found out you were going to Poplar Creek, you had to reach out to him. Arranged to borrow the equipment and arranged to get it back to him. So,
What was so unique about Poplar Creek that he was the only one that had the equipment?
The telephone exchange out there was old, so it didn't have modern equipment. So at the time, everybody was interested in ISDN, and they didn't. That was like non-existent in Poplar Creek.
Oh, Well. Our claim to fame with Poplar Creek is the radio station WGN. By that time, we'd come from IND to WGN, had a relationship with the management there. So the parking lot was sectioned off and named after all of us at the radio station.
Bob Collins and...
And Bob, of course, being the morning man, he had the parking spaces right up by the pavilion. Ours were the best, being the all-night people. We were the ones closest to the exit. And people wanted to park in the Steve and Johnny section because they could get out faster.
Yep.
And so at first I thought, well, oh, we're way out there. And then I realized,
We realized, whoops, yep.
That's the
quick exit.
Yeah,
yes.
That's where everybody wants to park. And when they tore down Poplar Creek, I wish we'd been able to save the signage because they had street signs with our names on it for that section.
And really, now that I think about it, I mean, we saw Eric Clapton, we saw Rod Stewart, and the first concert that we ever saw at Poplar Creek was when we were still at WIND.
Oh, yes.
And it was a promotion. They threw us together to take some listeners out to a Poplar Creek concert. It was a Joan Rivers.
And David Brenner was her opening act. And I had to come back from Poplar Creek to do my show on WIND. We weren't even dating then. And I asked you if you would come in with me because we were very upset that Joan Rivers was so blue. And there was a crowd of children in. It was really shocking.
We had both interviewed her to promote the concert. And there was no hint. We thought it was going to be a family-friendly Joan Rivers. And I'm not exaggerating. I won't get explicit. But within the first 30 seconds of her being on stage, she was doing gynecological humor.
Yeah.
And this was a family show.
Right.
Kids.
And we were with a busload. I think we had 50 IND listeners that had won the trip to the concert. And that made for interesting conversation on the bus coming back to town.
I mean, it's fine. If you want to do a blue show, do a blue show.
But tell.
Advertise that it's going to be a blue show.
Yeah. There were people leaving with their kids because they thought, oh, this will be just so fun to share a family night with the kids. And then they were like, oh, we're going to have to do a lot of splaining if we stay here any longer, so we better not. A listener says, the MARTA unit. this must be somebody in engineering, a 515 area code. He said, I remember the system well, Steve and Johnny. Thank you for mentioning it. Has to be an engineer if he has
warm... Oh, no, that's Pat Powers.
Oh, it's Pat Powers from Iowa.
Yes.
Oh,
thank you, Pat.
Yeah. He's our buddy. Been broadcasting for forever.
Pat is nice enough. His Saturday nights many times, consist of early in the evening, he will listen to the Grand Ole Opry on WSM, and then he segues to us later in the evening. So thank you for hanging out with
Pat.
Us, Pat.
We're going to take a break and come right back right here on WGN. I don't think it's going to work for him.
That's a little quieter than the shout bump we used last week.
John was all ready to surprise us with it, it's not cooperating.
So this is, we're kind of going for opposites instead of shout and loud, something very quiet.
Okay, now, silence.
Now we're going to do some shout-outs.
Yes, it's time now for some shout-outs. Just save that one for us for next week, okay, Jonathan?
That's the tease. Yes. Next week, you will hear... And Jonathan is banging his fist on the table. Goodness.
That's okay.
I'll own this one. That was on me, folks. We'll have another shout song next week.
Okay. Just imagine, shout. Here
Knock
we go.
Out. Da, 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 da.
Yes.
Should I start with some of the countries that check out our blog? And we would love it if you would check out our blog. Go to Steve and Johnny, spelled Johnny, JOHNNIE, steveandjohnny.wordpress.com. And we would love it if you would subscribe. No fee. We don't spam you. You only get an email when we do a new blog post. And we're amazed at some of the different countries that check in. The top 10, the United States, China, number 2, number 3, Singapore. Number 4, Hong Kong, SAR, China.
Mm-hmm.
Number 5, Belgium. Number 6, Canada. Number 7, Germany. Number 8, Australia. Number 9, Slovakia. And number 10, Puerto Rico.
I think that's a first, Puerto Rico.
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. Russia chimed in last week.
Mm-hmm.
No Russia this time around.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Folks who are listening to us tonight, George Clemens from Augusta, Georgia, is the first one in here. Thank you, George, for tuning in bright and early. Sherry Hanrahan is listening. Miriam in Stavanger is tuned in. Rob and Amy in Whiting, Indiana. Bing Besh is in Winfield. Sherry's in Bolingbrook. A bunch of folks chimed in with their concert memories. We'll get to those a little later tonight because there's some good memories. Stacey Drager is in Algonquin. Bill from Hobart is tuned in. And Donna Youngheim is in Oak Lawn. She said, come for pizza, stay for the original rainbow cone. Judy Graham is in Plainfield. She said she's listening on her AM FM weather clock radio that she purchased after the 1990 Plainfield tornado. She said, I still have my tornado aid tape and my VCR. We do too. So
yeah,
everything goes around, comes around. Linda Johnson and Linda Daniels are tuned in. Linda Daniels, I am so sorry. She's in Hazelcrest. She said, listening on my transistor radio. That tornado was so bizarre. I was looking at the behavior of the tornado that rolled through there on Monday. It actually came through, turned, and came back through Hazelcrest.
Yeah. Because on Monday, we were out in Munster with my brother, and it was a nasty storm.
It was scary because it touched down in Lansing.
And we got some tornado warnings, but fortunately, we never were hit by a tornado like some of the areas around us.
Like Lansing and Hazelcrest. And, oh my gosh, they call it an EF1, but the wind speed was over 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the behavior of a tornado to go through and then turn around and come back again. Just doesn't happen. Beverly Goodall. Beverly, we're thinking good thoughts for you. She fell and broke her arm above her shoulder.
Oh,
ouch.
Ow.
Yeah, and some folks are chiming in saying, been there, done that, and, you know, just hang in there. Laura Lampe is in the Villages of Florida. C. Estelle Beaumont is in Tampa. She's a regular listener, actually Fox Lake, Illinois. Patrice Tentari is in Northwest Indiana. Peter Jukabowicz is with us for the whole 5 hours. He's a big fan of Tom Appel's. And then we got some rainbow ice cream cones posted. Yes. Diane Vasquez is our graphics guru with a sweet August 1st graphic guru. Thank you. Mary Gold is also listening. Her hubby is with her, and they're listening from Tinley Park on their clock radio. Brian Lefevre is in Bridgeport, and a lot of folks are excited about the Bobby Fuller story.
Yeah.
And the book is good, and the author will be joining us after 10. Chuck Snitchler has three rabbits up because, of course, being the first of the month, it's Rabbit, Rabbit, Rabbit Day.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I love his picture.
Yeah.
It's of the WGN radio studio with a radio and three rabbits.
With headphones on, the three rabbits.
Well, of course.
Yes. Yes, thank you, Chuck. In Valpo, he tuned in. Eric Baum is in, oh my gosh, he is in Maine, Wells Beach, Maine, and he sends
an interesting picture.
A close-up picture.
It's a harbor seal.
It's adorable.
He said, truly a face only a mother could love.
No, I could love that. You won't buy me a monkey. Get me a seal. I want a harbor seal. Look at that sweet face. You can see that picture if you go to Stephen Johnny page on Facebook. Dr. Crypto is back with us. Thank you, Doctor. He's in Johnson Creek, Wisconsin. Bobby Danos is out in Sandwich, tuned in. And I'm going to bet that Debbie Tusick out in Sandwich is listening as well. Tracy Douglas.
As a matter of fact, Debbie checked in on our blog, mm-hmm. and she said, hi, guys. Hope your drive will be better this time. Not with Lollapalooza, or now with Lollapalooza going on. Oh, my. Pictures will be great to see. I'll be listening on my phone from Sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And we also heard from Robin Aiken, Stephen Johnny. Another great show tonight. I'll be listening from Port Charlotte, Florida on my cell phone.
Okay. Tracy Douglas is in Savannah, tuned in. Louise Palish is in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Sylvia Peterson from Racine, Wisconsin. We are really well represented in Wisconsin tonight. Susan Powell is in Memphis. Margot Moore is in Albuquerque. Carrie Johnson listening in Palm Coast, Florida. Bonnie Pearson's in Grace Lake. Jean Jacobson's in Milwaukee. Terry Brock in Bridgeview. Pam Wilk is in downtown. Well, she says, well, no, we're in downtown Chicago. Anyway, Pam, thank you for tuning in.
Is that where we are?
Yes. Ellen Maria is in Marengo. Kathy Engel is in Gilbert, Arizona, listening on the Alexa online. Greg Borman is tuned in Muskegon, Michigan. Peggy Castenshue in Munster, Indiana. Judy B. in Oak Lawn. Lloyd Moncrief in Ottawa. Tom Freed in Medina, Illinois. Chuck Gorsuch is in West Burlington, Iowa. Sandy Blackwell in Peoria. Susan Schimmel is in Lake Geneva. Joan Smith in Holland, Michigan. Larry Mann in Miami, Florida. Lynn Kinzer in San Antonio, Florida. Jeffrey Welchens is in Elkins, West Virginia. Helen Thomas is in K-Town. J.P. John Paul is tuned in. Carrie Hunt is in Ruskin, Florida. Scott Cooper is in Naperville. C. Estelle Beaumont is in Tampa. So really, Wisconsin and Florida mm-hmm. are fighting for being first in here with the most listeners from various points in both of those states. Marie Prudence is in Evergreen Park. Kim Cavaliero Keller is in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Todd Moe is in Egg Harbor, Wisconsin. Anthony Amadia tuned in. John Goodlow. Michelle Fairfield is in Peoria. Priscilla is in Joliet. Sandy McCombs in Michigan City, Indiana. And that's it for this week. If I missed you, I promise I'll get you next week.
We got a break for news. Out of the news, we're going to talk with Ron Smith, the author of He Fought the Mob, the true story of the Bobby Fuller Four. But the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. I got into radio back in 1966. And in 1966, I Fought the Law by the Bobby Fuller Four was a huge hit record.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out that Bobby Fuller had left us, I recall, even at this distance, I recall thinking something was odd, because unlike Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, Eddie Cochran, any of a number of people, you just didn't get a lot of information about what happened to Bobby Fuller.
And 60 years later, it's been a big, what happened to that 23-year-old talent? And he was a legitimate talent that mm-hmm. was destined to go places, but his life was cut short. 60 years ago, this summer marked the anniversary. Finally, somebody came along and said, I'm going to find out what I can find out about the Bobby Fuller story and what happened to him. And as a result, there's a new book called He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. And the author of that book joins us right now, Ron Smith. How are you tonight, Ron?
I'm great, Johnny. It's great to talk to you and Steve. You guys are legends. I'm honored to be on the air with you.
Well, I don't know about that. I have to ask you, Ron, because I know you are a native Texan and you have done a number of books that are crime-related books. What made you, especially after all of this time, what made you want to investigate the Bobby Fuller story?
Well, Steve, kind of as you introduced the story, I was 15 years old when Bobby Fuller was killed in 1966. And even as a teenager, as you put it so well, there was something odd about the story. So odd that it stuck with me for all of my life. And even as a kid, I knew that the official ruling of suicide just did not make sense for somebody who died in those circumstances. So I've been retired for a while. I started writing books as a hobby in my retirement. And as I began to think of the next one that I wanted to go on, I finally said, you know, I'm going to dive into this story. I'm going to see what I can learn. And I learned quite a bit more than I thought I would. It was a more interesting story than I thought it was going to be. It was a lot of fun to write.
I love the fact that you flesh out the book with just a flavor of what the world was like in 1966, the music that was popular. And, you know, I found myself going, yeah, oh, yeah, as I'm reading the book. And there were some real surprises about Bobby. And I have to tell you that I was shocked that he was only 23 years old when he died. That was stunning to me. And the band was originally called the Bobby Fuller and the Fanatics, right?
Yes, yeah. They started in El Paso, Texas. That was where Bobby and his brother Randy lived. Randy was in the band as well. And they moved to Los Angeles in 1964 to begin their career as a recording artist for a label called Delphi Records. Mm-hmm. And Delphi had once upon a time been a major label. They had been the label of Ritchie Valens. The owner of Delphi was a man named Bob Keane, who had actually discovered Sam Cooke mm-hmm. as a pop singer and was responsible for signing him to a contract. Unfortunately for Keane, he got kind of finagled out of any credit or money for that deal. But Bobby and his band moved from El Paso. They were admittedly, I think, novices at the recording business. And what happened to them along the way kind of happened to them because they were novices.
Yeah, they were really just kids.
Didn't know the right questions to ask.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold you for a second on the Bob Keane part of the story. One of the many things I love about your book is you really dig into the weeds. And you, for example, can you explain, and I love this story, why, when they released Sam Cooke's record, they put an E on the end of his name? I love this story.
Well, Bob Keane, as I said, owned the record label, and at that time it was called Keane Records. Keane had changed his name as a band leader earlier in his career, and he felt that adding an E to the end of it, I should back up and say he was forced to change his name because his name was too similar to the host of the radio show that he was leading the band for. So he had to come up with another name. He came up with Keane, added an E to it. And when Sam Cooke came along, Keane took credit for changing Cook's name and adding the E. I really don't think that's the way that it happened. I think Keane had a way of taking credit for things that he really didn't do, but he did claim that he put the E on the end of Sam Cook's name to differentiate him from his gospel singing career, in which his name was simply spelled C-O-O-K.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of silly, but it was the kind of thing that set Sam Cooke apart later when he had the pop career.
As you dug into the weeds of that era of music, were you surprised to find all of the politics that went on in the music industry?
I was not really. I follow music enough today to know that it's still part of it. It's mm-hmm. probably, there were probably more politics involved back in the 50s and 60s than there are today.
Yeah.
Everything, I think, is a little more forthright and cutthroat today with you're either on a label or you're not, or you're on a label for 5 minutes and then you're out. So I think it's a lot easier to see what's coming today than it was back in Bobby Fuller's day. But the politics, it was very interesting, and we'll get into this. I know the mob also influenced some of the politics mm-hmm. in the record business in those days, quite a bit, really.
Oh, we heard some stories about Chicago and that the influence on the record business in Chicago too. So, yeah, that was coast to coast, as I understand it. We got to take a quick break, Ron, and we want listeners to know that your book is now readily available. It's a brand new book, and it is a great read. The funny thing is, I find that people who weren't around in '66 when the song I Fought the Law was being played on the radio, they know the song because it just keeps popping up. It's like an evergreen. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, Ron, I find that through history, whenever there's like a news story that has to do with some, you know, bizarre crime that occurred, then this song would be used as a little theme mm-hmm. song to set up the news story. And I thought, it's had legs for 60 years. So we'll come right back with the author of He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. Ron Smith is our guest here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio, a Bobby Fuller Four, and a Buddy Holly song, Love's Made a Fool of You, and we're talking with the author of He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four, Ron Smith. And Ron, throughout his career, Bobby Fuller was always pretty heavily influenced by Buddy Holly, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And as were a lot of us who grew up in Texas in those days. Buddy Holly, of course, was a national recording artist, but those of us in Texas always kind of claimed him as our own, and especially those who were musicians. Buddy influenced an awful lot of people, including Waylon Jennings and others who came from Texas. But Bobby was he was heavily influenced by him, but he also wanted to be his own man, and I think that he was. If you read the book, you'll find that Bobby had a lot of headbutting with Bob Keane, the producer there who owned Delphi Records. And Keane always accused Bobby of trying to sound too much like Buddy Holly. But I think if you go back and listen to the full body of Bobby's work, you won't see it. It doesn't sound that similar to me. I think Bobby was a very creative young man, very talented. He was a musical prodigy from the time he was a child. And so, yes, growing up in Texas in that era, it was impossible really not to be influenced by Buddy Holly.
You say, and you write about the fact that he was a prodigy, and he actually started out on piano, right, as a little boy.
Yes. His mother played piano by ear, and she taught him as best she could. He very quickly flew by everything that she was capable of teaching him, and she got him professional lessons. But this was true of virtually every instrument that Bobby played. He, as soon as he was able to fiddle around on it for a few days or a month or two, he had mastered it. He was quite incredible. He went from the piano to playing some horns in school bands like the cornet and the trombone. Then he moved on to the drums. He was such a good drummer that at the age of 14, he was offered a scholarship to Juilliard School of Music. But because of his young age, his mother didn't want him to go. So, but that's just an illustration of just how talented this guy was. He taught himself the guitar over a period of a couple of months and was soon playing lead guitar in the garage bands that he was playing in there in El Paso.
We've got to talk a little bit about his mother, because she must have been a really, really special person, because the way you write about what she allowed Bobby and his brother to do at such a young age meant that she really felt that there was something there, that there was a talent, and she was determined to support them. Didn't she and her husband allow them to build a recording studio in the house?
They sure did. They allowed the two boys, Bobby and Randy, to cut a hole in the wall between the garage and the living room. And the garage became the control room, and they could stand up and look through the window into the living room, which was the studio, and they could watch as the musicians were playing and recording. The parents, there were quite a few anecdotes about the parents having company come over and have to sit around wires and speaker boxes. And they were very indulgent. And I might just interject here quickly that both of Bobby's parents had been married before they had Bobby and Randy. And each parent had lost a child. And so I think that probably encouraged the two boys.
Right.
Really follow their dreams, because they had experienced tragedy with two of their children earlier in their life.
Yeah. In fact, Bobby's mom had lost a son to murder. He was 10 years older than Bobby, right?
Right. He was a half brother of Bobby and Randy, and he disappeared one day from work. He was living in El Paso too at the time. And his mother woke up that morning with a premonition that something bad had happened to her son, Jack. And her husband and the boys tried to just write it off and say, you know, he's done this before.
Mm-hmm.
He's disappeared. He's gone off on a bender. He's gone across the border to Juarez, whatever. But he'll come back, Mom. But about 10 days later, someone was found driving Jack's car in Lubbock, Texas, and he was pulled over because it was reported as a stolen vehicle, and eventually the person driving the car confessed to murdering Jack. So that really sent the mom into a deep state of depression. There were several suicide attempts, and she was never the same after the loss of that son.
And I felt,
comes into play, of course, later on.
Yeah, and I felt in reading that story and realizing that she didn't want Bobby to go to Juilliard, she wanted to keep her kids close after going through that tragedy, that trauma. It's just, it's fascinating the role that she played in their life. And I'm trying to imagine, because Steve was a musician at that age, could you imagine your folks saying, sure, son, cut a hole in the wall and make a recording studio. And by the way, here's the money for the equipment that you need. That just was fascinating to me. And God bless her for doing it. Really.
I think she and her husband both recognized that the boys were talented, particularly Bobby. Bobby began writing his own songs when he was 14 or 15 years old. He had his own records pressed. He booked his own recording dates and then took the records around to radio stations there in El Paso and New Mexico. And, the parents indulged him quite a bit. I don't think Bobby's career would have ever really amounted to anything had he not had that kind of support from his folks.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
The book is called He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. It is a fascinating book, but I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit. Let's bring, how did he first encounter anybody from the mob?
Well, he encountered them without knowing it was his problem.
Mm-hmm.
there was a silent partner in the record company, Delphi, in which he was signed to, and this fellow was named Larry Nunes, spelled N-U-N-E-S, but Nunes was a record rack jobber, which meant those were the people that literally set up racks of records in record stores and department stores, and Nunes was not necessarily a full-fledged mobster himself, but when you were in that business, you could not help but associate with people in the mob, because the mob discovered early on that selling records, whether it be through jukebox plays in the 30s and the 40s or selling vinyl records in the 50s and the 60s, it was a great way to launder money. It was a great way to make money and not have to pay people because you had the mob behind you. So I think that Bobby was working for Delphi Records and working for someone who was connected to the mob, but yet coming from El Paso, Texas, and being a little bit green and also being ambitious enough to not really care. He just wanted a record deal. So when he had the deal, he didn't really ask a lot of questions at first, and that, of course, came back to bite him later on.
And his whole world changed when he ended up in New York. So, Ron, we're going to take a break. That's a classic cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's the tease.
When Bobby ends up in New York, things go really bad. The story is so interesting. The book is He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four, available now. Ron Smith is our guest. We'll take a break and come right back. We take you to New York and find out what happens to Bobby Fuller and the band, his brother and the other guys, the Bobby Fuller Four. That and more coming up here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. We're talking about Bobby Fuller. We're talking about the book He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. What you're listening to was the original 1964 demo that Bobby did of I Fought the Law.
Yeah. Ron Smith is our guest. Ron, that record was actually originally recorded in 1960 by the Crickets, right?
Correct. Following Buddy Holly's death, the Crickets found a new lead singer, a fellow named Sonny Curtis, and Sonny wrote that song. It was on one of the Crickets' album, but it didn't go anywhere. In fact, they didn't think that highly of it themselves. They made it the B-side of one of their singles, and it was really never heard from again, if it was heard from at all. But Bobby Fuller and his brother Randy, particularly Randy, discovered that song. Randy said, I think we could rock this up a little bit and make it a hit. So they did, and the version, as you just mentioned, was recorded in that home recording studio there in El Paso. And it was a big local regional hit, but being as that was the early 1960s, there was no internet, there were no social media platforms to promote the record, so it did very well locally, but that was about it. It was enough to make them famous in their neighborhood, I guess you could say.
Right, right.
Now, before we broke for the news, we teased that we were going to segue to New York.
Right, so the boys have left El Paso. They end up in California. Then in California with Delphi Records, they meet this guy who's also in Delphi Records, Larry Nunes, and he's responsible for setting up a tour that takes them eventually to New York, right, Ron?
Right. One of the complaints that the band had was that they were never really promoted very well on a national level by Delphi, so this tour was arranged that was a so-called national tour, although it really didn't cover that much of the country. They went up and they zigzagged back and forth across the Midwest for a while, but yes, the tour was arranged for a couple of stops in New York City, and that was very important in the storyline, because in New York City, they finally were exposed to some of the record label executives who had probably never really heard of the Bobby Fuller Four. They played a really exclusive club there called Ondine, and one of the people who came to hear them was a man named Morris Levy, who, if your listeners know anything about Morris Levy, they know that he was one of the most prominent record executives in the 1960s, and as well into the 70s. He was a very creative guy. He was he had a great ear for talent. He was also backed by the Genovese crime family in New York. So when Bobby and the band hit New York City and played, and Morris Levy came to hear them, this was all prearranged, I believe, between Larry Nunes and Levy.
Mm-hmm.
Levy had been watching the band from afar. They were a West Coast band. He was an East Coast record executive. But he had a way of signing people and not paying them. So because Bobby was complaining so much with his arrangements with Delphi, he wasn't being paid for his royalties. He really wasn't given any creative control over the records that they were making for Delphi. So in New York City, Morris Levy, who was also called the Octopus, put his tentacles on whatever he wanted, and because he was backed by the mob, he could get away with stealing artists from other labels or really doing whatever he wanted. Mm-hmm. So Bobby was in dire straits of needing some money because he hadn't been paid in so long by Delphi. He also was unhappy, as I said, with the creative side of things. So Levy, of course, knew exactly what to say to him and whisper in his ear. He made a deal with Bobby to acquire the copyrights to one of the single records that Bobby had done for Delphi and release it on the East Coast. And Bobby got paid some money for that. Therefore, he was in bed with Morris Levy, whether he wanted to be or not. Bobby, I think, believed he had cut a deal to have just one record and one copyright assigned to Levy, so it was a cash fix for Bobby. What he didn't realize was that once Morris Levy had an agreement with you in any form, he believed that he owned you. So Bobby and the band played New York a couple of times. The tour wound down. The band was breaking up. There was a lot of dissension in the band that Bobby was getting all of the publicity and all of the recognition. It was his name on the label. They were really just side players, that was never the deal that any of them thought they were going to sign on for when they left El Paso. But the band slowly was, because of all these problems and that they weren't being paid, the tour was not very well planned. They were staying in crummy hotels. They weren't eating well. They were riding around the country in an unair-conditioned van. So they limped their way back to Los Angeles, and I'm not sure where you want to pick up the story there, but Morris Levy was involved. Morris Levy was so deep with the mob that other record companies backed off whenever Levy said, "This is my artist."
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about Morris Levy, it reminds us of some interviews that we've had with Tommy James and Jimmy Rogers, both of whom told us stories of Morris Levy that makes you wonder what other stories will never be known of some of the things that he did and was probably responsible for. That had, in some cases, terminal impacts on people's careers.
He was not only the octopus, but he was also considered the godfather of music, and they meant that in a mob sense, right?
Exactly. He wasn't the godfather as if I'll take care of you boys.
Uh-huh.
He was the godfather just as you might think of the Corleone family.
Mm-hmm.
One of Morris's tricks was, just to show you the kind of person he was, he would take the artist on his label who had made records, and before the artist knew it, when the records came out, Morris Levy was listed as the co-writer of songs.
Yeah.
And which, of course, just took money out of the pockets of some of these people, but it just wasn't right by anybody's standards.
Well, they also pay a woman to be like a girlfriend / spy on Bobby, because there was some thought that he was going to go solo, so they needed to find out what he was thinking, what he was doing. So this Melanie ends up getting close to Bobby. That's just a chilling part of this whole story, that he's just kind of going through life with blinders on, and these people are doing these corrupt things around him. That's so creepy.
She was a call girl. Mm-hmm. She worked out of a club called PJ's. PJ's actually has some Chicago connections. It was started by several people from Chicago, Elmer Valentine being one, if you're familiar with him. Elmer went on to start the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was another fellow named Paul Raffles who came from Chicago. Anyway, they started this club in Los Angeles. It was just outside of Hollywood, and it was called PJ's. And it was mobbed up by everybody's standards. I was fortunate enough to be able to interview a couple of the band members that are still alive. And they played at PJ's, and they all told me the same thing, that you could just look around and tell this place was run by the mob. This guy, Paul Raffles, who ran the place, looked the part, slicked back hair. He was also in this Chicago. I believe he had something to do with, who was the mobster in Chicago? I'm drawing a blank.
Oh, the Giancanas?
Yeah, Giancana. Mm-hmm.
Right.
They all had ties back to him. So mm. Johnny Roselli came and went out of this club, too. So Melanie, as I said, was a call girl. Larry Nunes, who owned most of Delphi Records, had gotten wind that Bobby was unhappy. He hired this girl to become Bobby's friend.
Mm-hmm.
It was never known if they really dated romantically or not, but everybody believed they must have. But Bobby confided in Melanie everything that was going on in his mind about, I want to get out of this deal with Delphi. I want to start a new band. I want to sign with a different record label. And, of course, she was funneling all this information back to her employer, Larry Nunes. And mm-hmm. all of this kind of works towards the peak of, you know, the end of Bobby's life when he suddenly got everybody unhappy with him, and they're mostly mob-related people. He's got Morris Levy, who's hearing these rumors that Bobby is going to go do his own deal, probably with Atlantic Records.
Mm-hmm.
He's also heard that, you know, Bobby wants to give the money back to Levy that he had taken for the publishing deal, because he had heard enough and learned about who Morris Levy really was in the meantime. So then, of course, you've got Larry Nunes, who doesn't want to lose this artist from his record label. So Bobby was facing a lot of pressure, mm-hmm. and the band was breaking up when the tour ended, and they returned to Los Angeles. One of the band members, Jim Reese, the guitarist, found his draft notice in the mailbox waiting for him. So he was a goner from the band. And then the drummer, Dalton Powell, was from El Paso and was a family man, had a wife and a child who lived back in El Paso, and he wanted to quit the band to go back and, you know, take care of his family there locally. He just missed them. So that left Bobby and his brother Randy in the band, and Randy was not even sure if he was going to be included in whatever new incarnation of a band that Bobby's formed.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hit the pause button at that point. And when we come back, we will, because we are sadly running out of time, we're going to talk about the death of Bobby Fuller,
yeah.
and what we know and what we don't know and yeah. what may have happened.
Right. The book is He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. Ron Smith is the author. He's our guest. More coming up after this on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. We're talking with Ron Smith, the author of He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four. And sadly, because we're running short on time, we want to kind of cut to the chase. So I guess it's a kind of a two-part question. How did Bobby Fuller die, and what do we know about how Bobby Fuller died?
Well, it's known as Hollywood's greatest unsolved mystery. The day that he died, as we talked about earlier, Bobby had been pressured by a lot of people, most of them related to the mob. And on the night that on the night of July 18th, 1966, in the early morning hours, he got a phone call that drew him out of his apartment. So he left, and he was never seen again. His mom was living in the apartment with him at the time. She was visiting from out of town. The road manager was there as well, and they both saw Bobby leave. They both heard Bobby receive a phone call around 2. They both knew that Bobby had been being threatened by people from New York. So there was supposed to be a band meeting the next morning with Delphi Records and Bob Keane to discuss whether the band was going to break up or not. Bobby didn't show up for that meeting. To make a long story short, about 5 o'clock that afternoon, a car pulled up, Bobby's car pulled up onto the parking lot of the apartment complex where he lived. 2 men were seen getting out of it. Bobby was found in the laying across the front seat. He was already dead. One of the men was pouring gasoline across the front seat and across Bobby's body. It's assumed that he was going to torch the car, but Bobby's mother came along and interrupted them. She had been looking for the car all day long, waiting for Bobby to return. And when she saw the car, she ran over. I think that interrupted the plan to set the car on fire. 2 men that were going to interview with Bobby to be members of his new band happened to be there at the same time. And they saw these 2 men carrying Mrs. Fuller away from the car. She was hysterical. One of the band members, he was probably 19 years old at the time, went over to the car to see what was happening, and he saw Bobby laying across the car. The interesting part of the story is that when the police arrived to investigate, they almost immediately ruled it a suicide. Now, Bobby was in full rigor mortis at that time. For the police to rule that, okay, you've got this man who died a few hours ago, long enough ago that he's in full rigor. He's doused in fresh gasoline. And by the way, there were no car keys found with him. Yet they believed that he covered himself in gasoline and was going to set himself on fire. That was their version of the story. But there was $1 million insurance policy that comes into play here. It was taken out by Larry Nunes when Bobby signed with Delphi Records. In my book, my theory is that the $1 million insurance policy had a great deal to do with Bobby's death. He was an unhappy camper. He was not going to stay with Delphi if he had any say about it. He was probably going to find a lawyer to break the contract, for which there were many grounds to do so. So I think that Larry Nunes, along with Morris Levy, said, we're going to lose this guy, and he's more trouble than he's worth, so why don't we just cash in on that $1 million insurance policy? Problem for those guys was that if the thing was ruled as a suicide, the insurance policy contained a suicide clause, which would not have paid out. So mysteriously, about 6 weeks later, the official autopsy report came back with not a suicide ruling, but an accident ruling, which to me is even funnier because how is it accidental that somebody was in rigor mortis, driven to the site, someone poured gasoline on them, and you're going to call that an accidental death?
But unreal.
The accidental ruling freed up the payment of the insurance policy.
And yet, it just did not become front page news. People weren't saying, why? How could this happen? He was 23. This doesn't fit.
So from your research, is it reasonable to assume that there were forces at work at the time keeping all of this story out of the headlines?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. I believe that the mob had enough control that they could, number one, tell the police what to do with the body and the autopsy ruling, and I believe that they had enough influence that they could keep the newspapers and the media from covering it. That was one of the things that, as I mentioned early at the beginning here, as a 15-year-old listening to this story back in 1966, I knew that wasn't right. Why weren't they investigating this? Why wasn't it a bigger story? One of the funny things I mentioned in the book is that the following day, Frank Sinatra married Mia Farrow, and that really took over all the headlines in Los Angeles for the day.
At this distance, how difficult was it for you to come up with some of the information that you present in the book?
Well, it just took a lot of digging, a lot of research, used a lot of the newspaper archives from the day, not necessarily to cover the death, but because there really weren't any of those. But I kind of pieced together the story. And again, I was very fortunate to have interviewed people who played in the band with Bobby, who watched all this go down. And I spoke to the man who actually was the first to find the body. So lots of interviews, lots of phone calls, lots of digging in on the internet.
Well, you did a great job, really, Ron. A terrific job.
Well, thank you.
Was it difficult to get some of the people that you were able to talk to talk?
Yes, and they all wanted to talk, and I heard some really great rock and roll stories from these guys, but everyone was reluctant to put their two cents worth in about the mob and the involvement. One person I spoke to, who's in the book, did believe he had no qualms about it. He said that it was a mob hit. He was aware of the details of Bobby's agreement with Morris Levy. So these guys wanted to talk, but what I have found in the past, even with Bobby's own brother who wrote a book shortly before he died, he didn't want to go there. And he would go right to the edge of the pool, but he wouldn't put his toe in when it came to talking about the mob.
Because there are possibly still some tentacles, some octopus tentacles that might reach out?
I think he was that afraid of them,
Yeah.
Wow.
And here we are 60 years later, and it's got all the makings for a great movie, and the movie hasn't been made. I'm like, okay.
Well, I hope it will be.
I hope so, too, because it's got, the way you've laid it out in your book, this is movie material.
And one of the things I love about the book, you can open this book to any chapter, and you're drawn in.
Yeah.
It's really well written,
thank you.
Ron. So where is the best place for people to get the books? Go to ronsmithbooks.com, or where should people buy it?
Yeah, well, if you can buy it on Amazon, it's available in e-form as a Kindle book. You can go to my website, which is ronsmith-books.com, and it will take you to the marketplace. I'm working on a deal to try to get it with one of the major brick-and-mortar retailers, but we're not there yet. So those are the best ways to get it that I just described.
And for anybody who's wondering, I want to throw in here, we didn't get a free copy. We heard about this. We bought the book.
It was your birthday present.
It was.
It surprised you last week with it.
And, well, I'd heard about it, and I expressed interest, and it was a birthday present. And it's a fascinating book.
So thank you for writing the book, Ron. And you know what? If it turns out that anything else develops as a result of you writing the book, use us. Come back on the show, because there's so many more stories to be told.
Oh, yeah. We have just scratched the surface. And when you find out if there's going to be a brick-and-mortar place that's going to be handling the book, we'd be happy to have you back on and talk about that,
Absolutely.
Too.
That'd be awesome. Y'all are great.
Thank you so much, Ron. Appreciate it. And again, we appreciate your book, He Fought the Mob, The True Story of the Bobby Fuller Four, readily available. We found it on Amazon. 5-star read. Absolutely.
More coming up. Stay with us at WGN. Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. And speaking of eating things, there is a 100th anniversary.
Yes.
That we can't ignore. Rainbow Cone, 100 years
old. Yes. Joining us now is food journalist David Hammond. He's also the co-author of a terrific book entitled Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. Hey, David, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Johnny and Steve. I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Good. I was going through the folks who text in to tell us where they're listening, and we have 19 states that are listening tonight. So we have to start with the basics, because I bet at least a few of those folks have no idea what a rainbow cone is. So how do we describe it, David?
Well, I'll describe it, but to your point, Johnny, I think there's some Chicagoans, probably more than you'd think, who've never heard of a rainbow cone.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
it developed on the southwest side. Now they have like 20 locations and five trucks going around the city offering this ice cream cone. So its visibility has been enhanced significantly over the last couple of years. But here's what it basically is for those who haven't seen it. It's an ice cream cone, of course, but it has five different flavors on it, and they're all stacked on top of each other in a rather unique way. Those flavors are chocolate, of course, strawberry, and those were two flavors that were around in 1926, chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla.
Right.
But that was pretty much it. So in addition to the chocolate and strawberry, this guy named Joe Sapp, who invented the rainbow cone, put Palmer House on top of strawberry. Now, Palmer House, no relation to the hotel by the same name in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it got the name Palmer House. That, perhaps Joe just made it up at the time. Mm-hmm. It's a it's kind of a vanilla studded with cherries and walnuts. It adds a little texture and a little fruit flavor.
Oh, yes. It's so good.
It is. And on top of that, they have pistachio almond.
Yes, yes.
Which was must have been kind of unusual in those days. I mean, it's been big in Italy for a long time. I don't know if pistachio was a normal, regular, standard ice cream flavor in Chicago. I doubt it. Certainly not pistachio almond. And then on top of all that, you have orange sherbet. So you have this stack of, they're more like layers. They have a Joe Sapp, who was also, aside from being an ice cream entrepreneur, was also an engineer. So he engineered this kind of slicing scoop that would cut relatively thin, like maybe a half an inch slabs of ice cream, and then he could put them on top of each other.
Right.
And because they were connected by a flat side, they stayed together.
They wouldn't slide off. Because if you did if you did scoops, it would be like very precariously perched up there.
Yeah, they'd be falling all over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was fairly brilliant right there.
Yeah.
And it seems like a rather improbable success as well. Now, Joe got the idea, Joe and his wife, Catherine, got the idea because they were located, they're like 92nd and Western. They still have a location there.
Right.
They were located near a lot of cemeteries, Mount Greenwood, Mount Olivet, St. Casimir, Holy Sepulchre, Mount Hope, and others. Lots of cemeteries there. And on Sunday, people would go pay their respects to family members and friends who were in those cemeteries.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the way home, family could stop at Rainbow Cone and get a Rainbow Cone to kind of cheer the kids up and give them something to gnaw on the way home driving home with the parents. Joe was really a kind of an interesting entrepreneurial guy. He decided that in addition to this little ice cream stand, and it was a standalone. There's only one Rainbow Cone in Chicago for a very long time. Now there's, as I said, like 26
different
locations for it. He built a little garden in back.
I love this. Yes.
And he put a radio there. And this is 1926. A radio is perhaps not as common in every household, but he put a radio out there. And so he could play songs. And there was a group called the original group was the Hoosier Hotshots. They were an Indiana group. He had a bunch of live performers called the Rainbow Hotshots. So when people stopped by on Sunday after visiting the cemetery, a somber occasion, of course, they could stop and lighten up the atmosphere by having a rainbow cone and listening to the Hoosier Hotshots.
And of course, they were coming to a pink building too, which was also very cheery. But I love the fact that people could sit out back and listen to the radio, and even some people would get news by sitting there with other people eating their rainbow cone, which cost how much 100 years ago, David?
Well, this is also another factor in its improbable success. The rainbow cone itself was 12 cents. Now that was a time. 1926, the average U.S. manufacturing job paid 60 cents an hour. So if you brought a family of five there and all got rainbow cones, that's an hour's worth of work you're talking about to get there. So it was a luxury, but people were willing to pay for it because it was so special. And it was, I mean, if they were coming from a cemetery, it was definitely kind of a downbeat atmosphere. And so they raised it up a little with something as merry as a rainbow cone. Although, of course, there's no brown or in a rainbow, but there isn't a rainbow cone.
I remember being troubled by that as a kid, the first time I had a rainbow cone. I was like, oh, this is odd. Because on paper, those five flavors should not go together. I mean, the chocolate and the orange works for me, but the other ones are like, I don't think so, but they do work.
And on a hot day in Chicago, oh boy.
It's heaven. Heaven in a cone.
Very cooling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cooling and happy, too. I mean, a rainbow cone just looks happy.
You're
now,
right.
Many people are being introduced to the rainbow cone by an innovation that the granddaughter of the Saps, let's see if I can remember her name.
Lynn?
Lynn Sapp. Thank you very much. Lynn had the bright idea first to go to Taste of Chicago, which was a introduction of rainbow cone to the north side.
Right.
I mean, people who had never heard of the rainbow cone before ran to it.
Well, wait. As a north sider, I heard of it, but we just did not go south of Madison Avenue to get a rainbow cone.
I was a north side kid. I grew up in Portage Park.
Okay.
So it's like directly north of Beverly. But I don't think I had ever heard of it until I ran into it, perhaps at like Taste of Chicago or some event. But you're more worldly than I, Johnny.
And for people listening to us all over the country who would like to get an idea of what we're talking about, point your web browser to rainbowcone.com/rainbow100. And on the computer right next to me, I've got this wonderful video that is making me so hungry a rainbow cone.
I know.
It is just, hey, David, you can almost taste. I want taste and sniff.
Stop. David, sit tight. We're going to take a quick break and come right back.
Okay.
We're talking about the 100th anniversary of Rainbow Cone. And as a North Sider, you're saying, well, yeah, we've got one over there by Bona Beef. Yeah, that's true. But back in the day, this was a very, very special and innovative thing that was being offered 100 years ago. David Hammond is our guest right back after this on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. Can't you just see the guy pulling down the street?
Yeah, it's
selling the ice cream
cones.
It's
a modern day version of the, because I think it used to be Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. When you heard it, you was like, money, I gotta get some money, right? We're talking with David Hammond. David did a great article in the Trib on the history of Rainbow Cone, and you had an amazing fact. So at the beginning, when Rainbow Cone came out 100 years ago, there's chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry, and then they came along with these exotic flavors. But in 2022, there was a report that indicated 400 new ice cream flavors had launched over a single four-year period. 400 flavors?
Ice cream is one of those products that survives by constantly innovating. I mean, there's some standard flavors that are always going to be there, but if you look in the frozen food cabinet, the ice cream cabinet, a grocery store, there's new flavors every year. Now, that article came out in a McKinsey & Company report that over the preceding 4 years, 400 new ice cream flavors had been launched. Some of those flavors included Kraft macaroni and cheese ice cream.
And
it gets worse. Bone marrow with smoked cherries.
Or not.
Or not, right. They didn't say, these aren't successful flavors, just flavors that had been introduced.
Yes.
And it's like with candy, too. Candy manufacturers also bank heavily upon novelty, coming up with new types of candy that'll throw kids. Same thing with ice cream.
Was it Ben and Jerry's that had like a Stephen Colbert flavored cone?
They like to acknowledge Jerry Garcia was one of the most popular
Jerry
ones, right,
Garcia,
David?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was real happy to read and see a picture of Lynn Sapp, the granddaughter. So the family is still actively involved in seeing to it that Rainbow Cone stays true to Rainbow Cone as it continues to spread out all across the city.
Yes, they're listed as co-owners with Bona Beef, and I talked to John Bonavolanto, who's in the Bona Beef family and does marketing for Bona Beef, and he said they were able to modernize a lot of procedures, processes within Rainbow Cone, which I definitely believe. Bona Beef has a lot of locations, so what they're doing is locating rainbow cones within Buona Beef, which we have one right near our house in Oak Park. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a nice setup. You go get an Italian beef and then for dessert, get a rainbow cone.
Right, right.
A lot of food.
A listener wants to know if you can actually say, well, I don't want that flavor on my rainbow cone.
Oh, yeah.
Is that against the rules if you say I'm not a chocolate person?
I'm sure it is. You can have all chocolate if you want or all vanilla. It's they're fairly liberal rainbow cone. Have it, or you can have it in a bowl, which honestly is the way I go. I mean, maybe I'm a killjoy in that respect, but
yeah.
I have a hard time balancing even the five well-engineered slices.
At least you recognize that it could get ugly if you're trying to balance a rainbow cone.
And who, if you eat ice cream too quickly, you know, you get a sore head. So
a brain.
Yeah. I prefer to have it in a bowl and kind of take a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But you can basically get a rainbow cone in a bowl with a cookie if you want to, if you still want to have that little crunchy experience along with the cone and along with the dish of ice cream. And they do have a lot of other products now too, like rainbow cone cakes and so mm-hmm. on. I think it's destined for travel beyond the United States, excuse me, beyond Illinois. There actually is one in Bradenton, Florida. And I'm guessing that's Lynn Sapp's doing it. She spent a lot of time in Florida.
Right.
But that, as far as I know, is the only location outside of Illinois.
Do you know if they've ever thought about marketing, like you could go into a Jewel and buy the Palmer ice cream? Because I would think that would be wildly popular once you've had it.
That's interesting. You know, I don't think that came up when I was chatting with Lynn, but that's not a bad idea.
No.
Although it is, people do think of it, although I guess they could make a cone, kind of like a drumstick maybe, with really thin layers of ice cream on it.
You know what, David? I'd be willing to try. I'd be happy to experiment to see if I could make that happen.
Yeah. So could you walk into Rainbow Cone with your own menu and say, okay, I want this, and just design a designer Rainbow Cone for
like
you?
The orange first.
I don't see why you couldn't do that. I mean, they're selling the ice cream there in all kinds of configurations,
right.
So why not configure? They probably, to be honest with you, Steve, I'm guessing they don't want to publicize that flexibility too much.
That's true.
Yeah, it makes it easier.
You're right. Because there's a lot of dipping going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just such a great story. And I was blown away when I read your story that the rainbow cone was 100 years old. And the role that the place on Western Avenue has played in that community over the years is just, it's amazing. And just the whole image of people spending 12 cents when they were making, you know, 60 cents an hour.
What brilliant marketing when he started that.
The Saps were really on top of things.
Yes. And I guarantee he did it without a marketing consultant.
Yeah,
to
do. Absolutely.
They knew what they liked. They knew what probably would work, and they made it happen with things like that cool scoop that Joe Sapp invented.
Right.
And I think, Johnny, were you a Southside gal?
No, Steve, Southside, I'm Northside.
We have a mixed marriage, Southside guy, Northside girl, but I have converted her into being a Sox fan.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, very good, very good. Yes, if rainbow cone is one of those foods that developed on the South Side that is not very well known on the North Side.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, things like the Jim Shoe sandwich or the mother-in-law or Kathy Grapes. Those are all things. I mean, those names are probably very foreign to many Chicagoans, but they're well recognized on the South Side. On the North Side, we have the Michelin starred restaurants, the James Beard Award winners, and there are a few of those on the South Side as well, but not nearly as many as on the North. What you have are a lot of little mom and pop places that look at what they've got in front of them on the counter, and they think, how can I make this more interesting? How can I do something with what I have that people will find new and cool?
We communicated via text earlier this week, and I said, putting a bug in your ear, as a food journalist, you need to do the story on fair food, because I am so intrigued by the bizarre things that they're offering at state fairs. And they're just opening up this year with the rundown of some of these things, and it just blows my mind.
It does. Yeah, I had my first chocolate-covered fried Twinkie at a state fair.
Oof.
That is now the only way I'll eat a Twinkie.
Okay.
They got a chocolate-covered fried.
And what was it when we went to the Milwaukee Fair? The elephant ears?
Oh, the elephant ears. Yeah, they're standard. That's it's fried dough with powdered sugar.
Kind of like bear claws.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, they just melted. Mm-hmm. I'm so hungry, and guess what I have for snacks tonight? I have a bag of gluten-free Cheez-Its. It's not very exciting.
they taste pretty good.
They do taste good. Hey, David.
Any blatant plug? Any new things people should, new books or anything people should know that you've got coming out?
No, we are considering some updates to our book, Made in Chicago, Stories by 30 Great Hometown Bites. There's a... Atomic Cake, which we mentioned in our presentation, but not in the book. It's kind of a multi-layered cake. Cohasset Punch. Now, I bet you guys remember, there used to be a sign on Madison, a big neon sign with a lighthouse on it that said Cohasset Punch. It was a type of punch that was invented in Chicago. It went out of business in the 80s. Hmm. And then this young guy, Greg Shutters, made some money. He developed fonts and he made a little extra money. He thought, I'm going to bring back Cohasset Punch. So he did. And now you can get it at places like Binny's, which is nationwide.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really pleasant kind of citrusy pomegranate colored punch.
Mm-hmm.
And here's something kind of interesting. Pasta carbonara. Now, where did that come? Where would you think that came?
Italy.
Of course. Probably Rome. I would have guessed. There's some evidence that it might have been developed in Chicago.
Oh.
The first mention of pasta carbonara is in a cookbook from Chicago published in 1952.
Okay.
The thinking is that vets from World War II, like my dad, who were stationed in Italy, wanted to have something that would remind them of home. So they had pasta carbonara, which is basically eggs and bacon in pasta.
So good.
And they brought that back to the United States where it caught on, and people just naturally assume it's from Italy, and honestly, it may be, but there's some debate now as to whether it may have developed in Chicago.
You know what,
something else would like to
I tell you what you've about. Done. You've reminded us that we got to get you back in here, and we got to talk about more Chicago food.
And you've made us
so hungry.
So hungry.
David, thank you so much for joining us tonight. David Hammond, the co-author of Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. News is next right here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. It should come as no surprise that we are huge fans of mom-and-pop businesses, local businesses. And there was one that we were very sad when it shut down a few years ago.
3 years ago, a theater that we frequented many, many years after running for over a century on the north side of Chicago, the 400 Theater had closed down. But the last day of July, yesterday, Friday, everything changed. The projectors were running. The popcorn was popping in. The people were lined up outside because the 400 is back. And the guy responsible for the 400 Theater is Jordan Stansel. Jordan, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I feel like we're forcing you to catch your breath for a few minutes because I bet it's been so crazy for the last 24 hours.
It's been pretty crazy for the last, I think, 10 days and even a lot longer than that. We got our final business license and you know, place of amusement license and all our final approval from the city on July 22nd. And no one who worked this weekend even knew they were working.
Oh my gosh.
So we put it all together and we had five people there today working, and I had to work. We all worked, and it's been long days, but you know, people are just thrilled to be back in that theater, and it's just been really inspiring to hear the stories, and the number of people that just come up to me and say thank you is pretty cool. I mean, I don't know, you know, that's pretty nice. That feels good.
Well, what drew you to the 400 Theater? Because as Johnny was saying, we've been fans for a long time, and we know of people who have come from other states to the 400 Theater.
Yeah.
It's a great place. What made you want to resurrect this theater?
Well, I have a long background in movie theaters. My great-grandfather founded the Rialto Theater in Grayling, Michigan in 1915. and it's a single screen theater that's still open today. Hmm. And I was a Foreign Service officer, and then I taught for a while after that. And I went back to Grayling, Michigan, and wanted to revive that theater. So I got into the industry that way. I just became kind of fascinated with, you know, doing that. And then after the pandemic, there were some opportunities to get another location that I bought last year in Big Rapids, Michigan. And that opened in April. So this is actually the second theater, the 400 is the second one that we've done this in 4 months, which I think is pretty good because, you know, we have a... sometimes you hear about theaters that close for renovations and it takes them a year. And
yeah.
I just stay open. You know, we're going to start remodeling the 400 now.
Wow.
And so what, you know, this is going to be ongoing. We got the projection and sound and we have two auditoriums operating and we have it at spec. We have everything. We can put the movies on in the right way. We have a great presentation and then everything else we're going to just keep doing, you know, mm-hmm. Maybe you take part of the week off or something, or you know one section is closed for a short time. But the whole movies have to show every day. That's just how we do it.
Right.
I have to ask, as an independent mom and pop shop, how the heck were you lucky enough to get Spider-Man for this weekend? How cool is that?
Yeah, it is cool. I mean, I think you know, I already have, relationships with the distributors and with the studios from the other theaters. And so they know who I am. So I think that helped, I guess. And, but yeah, it was pretty funny because it was like, we got our approval to get open. And I said, well, you know, I can't, it's July 22nd. I couldn't do the last Friday, July 24th. That would have been too extreme, but I said, I bet we can do Spider-Man, you know, and, we just called Sony and said, you know, can we play the 31st? They said, yeah, you know, so it was pretty cool and we got it going.
That's amazing.
And do you have to do any remodeling to accommodate digital technology or was that kind of in place for you?
Well, that stuff was in place and we basically had, there's four screens there. We're actually only operating two right now. We're still working on, we have a third that we're going to open next week, and we have a fourth that we'll work on maybe a little longer. We'll see how it goes. Because one of the things I just really believe in is you have to play the movie the right way. And that's, I think that's the basis, you know, that's the foundation. And so I think a lot of people miss that because that's really where the audience spends their time. You know, mm-hmm. You can work on the lobby, you can work on the bathrooms. I'm not saying those things aren't important or that we won't do that, but the main thing is you got to be able to sit in that chair, hear the sound, see the picture the way it was intended. And there's a lot of technical details to that. I've been fortunate to have good people that, you know, that I've found who are really talented at reviving and refurbishing and fixing and tuning. And I mean, it's a really big process. It's hard to put on a movie the right way. A lot of times you go to a theater and frankly, you know, unfortunately in our industry, sometimes it's not being done well.
Mm-hmm.
It's dim or the sound isn't working. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
something wrong.
Yep.
There's flaws, you know, mm-hmm. and I think it's a problem. I mean, it's just, and even if you're not an expert, they, you know, you'll have theaters say, well, nobody notices. Well, you do notice, you know,
yeah.
you don't have to be an expert. You don't, maybe you can't identify what's wrong, but you just don't feel that great feeling of being overwhelmed by how awesome it is that you do feel if it's done the right way.
And if it's
and so
done,
that's the first thing, yeah.
And if it's done incorrectly, you find yourself comparing it to watching it on your mm-hmm. big screen TV at home, and you go, well, you know,
say,
what?
Yeah,
streaming,
why did I do this?
Yeah, well, streaming's better, and in the long run, it's cheaper, you know, especially if you're looking at, you know, maybe $20 a ticket. In fact, I was
blown. Well, not at our place.
That's right. I was blown away yeah. by your admission price. You want to roll through those for us?
Yeah, not including the taxes, which are significant mm-hmm. in the city. But you know, we have $11 at night, $8.50 in the afternoon, and it's $6 on Tuesdays all day. We have a kind of a and also $6 for children under 12. We have a somewhat unusual approach of not really doing any other discounts or categories. And part of that's just to say, it's just low for everybody.
Yeah.
And we don't do, you know, if you're a senior or you're whatever you are, or student,
mm-hmm.
you know, we just say that's the deal. And we're not going to sit here and ask you to show ID or something, you know, and we just move things along that way. And I think it's better. And plus, you know, a lot of the discounts, sometimes it's, it might not really be, you know, senior citizen, meaning what, a retired cardiologist? I mean, you know, versus somebody else that maybe has three kids and they're 29 and, you know, maybe who should get the discount. So I don't know. So I just keep it low so nobody cares, you know.
That's good.
What it really costs.
But now here's the key question. Do you get real butter on your popcorn?
You get real butter.
Yes!
What?
Yes!
And yeah, and you know, it has a lot. Butter has vitamin A, and you should eat it. And,
that's right.
I you know, don't want to miss that one.
So. Oh my gosh! Take us to the outside of the theater, because my recollection is, and I haven't driven by there in forever. The overhang has the little like Edison lights trimming it out. Are they still there?
Yes, that's all still there. We really. Besides cleaning that and getting as many of those replaced as we could, that's still exactly what you're saying.
Nice.
And, you know, it's just, I think there's actually a historic marquee that would be kind of cool to put back there that I've seen in some photos. So, you know, maybe longer term we do something like that. Because I think restoring some of that stuff is really important. I mean, you can't put the 400 back to what it used to be, which was a big single screen theater. And I've, you know, I signed the lease for this back in December, so I've had a lot of time to kind of get to know the building, and some of its surprises. There's always going to be more, but, you know, it's going to be the way it is. It's not going to get restored to whatever it was originally. And right. I don't think it was really like a movie palace ever. You know, I don't think it was like something that really needs to do that. But I think some details would be kind of cool to go back. And that's kind of why I call it the 400 Theater, because I know it's had different names, but I think the main kind of historic one is that. So we don't say the new 400 theaters. We don't say any of these other, you know, the different iterations of it. But, you know, we're just using that basic 400, which is an awesome theater name because, I don't know, that's so unusual.
It is very unusual.
Yeah.
We got to take a quick break. We're talking with Jordan Stansel. Can we ask you to hang in there for just a couple minutes and we'll come right back?
Sure.
Jordan is our guest. He's the guy behind the 400 Theater. It's open in Rogers Park. We'll get right back to him here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putnam at WGN Radio. We're talking with the new owner of the 400 Theater, Jordan Stansel. And Jordan, we know, but we can't assume everybody knows where the theater is. So where is it and how do you get there if you're coming, for example, from downtown Chicago?
Yeah, it's at 6746 North Sheridan Road. It's just a few blocks north of the Loyola stop on the Red Line. And it's pretty easy to get there because, you know, we're right on Sheridan. And we're kind of between the Morris and the Loyola stops on the Red Line. And there are numerous bus lines there. You know, it's a good location because you can go to the beach. The other theaters I have aren't near beaches, so that's so I like this. They said, you know, we don't have a break room because it's so tight to the old building. I said, you know, you go to the beach.
Just walk down to the beach for a half hour.
It's a block away. We got nice, so you go. And,
One of my recollections from the 70s was going to the 400 Theater for a midnight show. You have any plans on bringing back maybe theme weekends or midnight shows, anything like that?
Yeah, 100%. We have the first people that we paid in this whole operation were actually programming people, because I think one of the issues that I think is so important today is to have a creative program and something that's going to be interesting. So, you know, we really have been working on that, and I think we'll play like, you know, upward of 40 titles a month because you'll do a lot of repertory screenings, a lot of independent movies, late night like you're talking about, you know, Sicko Saturdays for the late night show or something, right? So, you know, so there's a lot of good things, and, you know, we just want to have fun with it. I think that you have to just, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and my family did it. And if you have to take it real seriously, because there's certain things you have to do, you have to take care of. But if you don't have fun with it, then it's like, why are you doing this? You know, and people want to have fun. They want to go out and see something you know, you mentioned like sort of the competition with streaming and quality and stuff like that. A lot of it is just about going out and just doing something cool and unusual. And so maybe that's going to be older movies. Maybe that's going to be foreign films. Maybe that's going to be documentaries or, you know, we're going to hit all of that. And we have enough screens and also the opportunity to do something like, you know, as you brought up Spider-Man, which we're playing. And so you can do, I think we're going to just kind of be, I like to describe it as almost a college radio station, you know, just sort of that eclectic programming. And yeah, you know, it's just kind of a little bit out there. So,
I love that. We've already mentioned Spider-Man, but I love that you have paired Spider-Man with I Want Your Sex.
I want your sex, yeah, and we've had a lot of laughs about, you know, people coming in and saying, you know, what are you playing? And our response is, I want your sex. And, you know, and not too many people have heard of that movie. There are, Greg Araki's a well-known director for in certain communities and certain fans. He's had a lot of fans. But other people really aren't even aware of this. So they're laughing, you know, and so it's like, well, really? I mean, this is what you're going to say. So, yeah, it's a mix, but that's exactly right. That's kind of, we did that on purpose because, you know, it's emblematic of kind of just, like, what even is this? I mean, this is total eclecticism, you know.
Well, in fact, shouldn't that be your slogan? What even is this?
That's the t-shirt.
What are we doing here?
That's the t-shirt for the 400 Theater. What even is this?
Well, because nobody thinks you can bring these places back.
That's
and I
right.
I think that it's really cool. I mean, the Rogers Park community really wants this. And, you know, that's what makes it work. I mean, I think if they... I mean, that's what, you know, you asked earlier, you know, what made me specifically with that particular theater. I mean, the neighborhood really cares about that place.
Yeah.
And I think without that, you're toast, you know, but they really like it.
I remember talking to the alderman from that district when it shut down because the neighborhood was saying, no, we cannot let this turn into another condo. We've got to save our theater.
Yeah.
And then you come along and you do just that. Will you be offering, I even hesitate to ask this, kids movies? Things that are specifically?
Yeah, we will. Actually,
really?
Because I do think we should have, well, there are a lot of families there. And I mean, we've had, you know, there have been a lot of kids even this weekend that go to Spider-Man. And we actually have an elementary school group coming on Thursday to watch Spider-Man from Kilmer Elementary.
Oh,
that's just right around, kind of right very few blocks away. And they reached out to me, one of their teachers reached out to me right when we signed the lease, and she heard about it, said, you know, we used to bring groups there, can we do that again? And I said, yeah, and then they got back in touch last week and said, can we come right now? You know, and so how about next week? So, you know, they just want to use the space, and it's just, it's pretty inspiring.
Well, again, for people who do show up there, the renovation will be happening as the theater is in business. So it's not like you shut it down and then when you open the doors, everything is in place. It is all safe for you to come in. The sound is good. The projector is great. Did you have any problem getting people to work at the theater?
Far from it. I mean, we didn't really even put out any ads. I had a couple Facebook posts where I mentioned, you know, you could send in a resume, but I didn't, there's nothing on, you know, like Indeed.com or something like that. No open interviews. We're just, because people write in and say, you know, can I do it? And so I just have a lot of people to choose. And now we have a manager who's, you know, helping me do those things. And she's learning the ropes and everything and hasn't managed a theater before. But, you know, had some food service experience and also, you know, is involved in some filmmaking programs in the city and is also, you know, based in Rogers Park and actually grew up in Rogers Park. So I think that's really important. And so, it hasn't been hard to staff. And I don't know, but I'm tough, you know, because I people have to do the movie theater the right way. I mean, we have a famous story in my family, you know, that we had the big old marquee on the front of the theater. And, you know, my great grandfather came back from a business trip in the really, really late at night, and the kid that had changed the marquee spelled the word wrong, and he drove right to the kid's house and got him out of bed, you know, and said, "You're coming downtown, and you know, you can't do that." So I don't know if that would be legal today to behave that way as an employer, but we have, you know, we You gotta do it right.
So. Do it right. Yeah, that's your mantra. Congratulations. Yeah. And thank you from the bottom of our collective hearts for making this happen and for making it happen at a reasonable price too.
Now, where's the best place for people to follow you? Obviously, they can go to your website, 400theater.com, Facebook, Instagram, anything else we should know about?
We have Facebook. We just started Instagram, I think yesterday or the day before, so we're there. Mm-hmm. You can sign up to receive emails on the website, and we send the show times. Usually we try to do it every Wednesday morning so that you have some time for the weekend to get ready. So that's a good way to get an update. And we'll also have an app because our ticketing system will have an app. And if you have the app, then that's actually the easiest way to just with one tap, you can always check the show times that day, buy tickets, reserve seats. And the app also is cool because it has ad-free trailers for the movie. So, when you want to watch a movie trailer these days and you have to sit through. And, the trailer is an ad. And I'm always like, why am I watching an ad before the
end?
To see another ad.
That's wild.
So we have ad-free on the app, but you got to download the app. So.
That's so cool. Well, thank you so much, Jordan. We're going to come
see you
real soon. I just love the idea that you've got the Northwestern crowd, you've got the Loyola crowd, you've got that whole area of folks that are, excited about seeing the 400 open up again, just as we are.
But by the way, I see that you play local radio stations as people are getting into the theater. Yeah. I have a suggestion for a Saturday night radio show.
Yes.
You might want to pipe in there.
I think we could do something. Yeah, I think we could do something with that.
Jordan, stay in touch with us. If we can use you, if you can use us in any way, please do let us know, okay?
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Take care. Jordan Stansel is the guy behind the reopening.
We are absolutely going up.
Yes.
And I love that. Spider-Man, Brand New Day, and I Want Your Sex. I love that.
It's a comedy, so it's not like an X-rated movie. And the prices up for evening shows, $12.68 for adults before 5 p.m., $9.80 all day on Tuesday.
Compare these prices.
Yeah.
It sounds like a blatant plug. Well, yeah, it's a mom-and-pop place, and he's doing good stuff. Compare these prices to what you will see at a lot of the big theaters.
And you're going to see the place go through transformation as he's able to renovate it as time goes on. So, again, congratulations to Jordan and all the powers that are making the 400 happen these days.
We got a lot more coming up. We're going to talk all things automotive with Tom Appel, the publisher of Consumer Guide, after the news, which is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. Well, anytime you hear music like that, you know it has to be one of Tom's tunes.
That's good stuff.
Tom being Tom Appel, the publisher of Consumer Guide. I think I'm going to like tonight's theme. What would that be, Mr. Appel?
Tonight's theme is That's Good Guitar.
Yeah. And I know who that is, but explain to the kids who that is.
Yeah, that's Dick Dale off an album called Tribal Thunder from 1993. That cut is called Nitro. And that album is really caffeinated. Everything on that album is that intense.
Oh, yeah.
That's the best description, though, caffeinated.
Yeah.
It's just like high energy.
And a lot of people remember Dick Dale from a wonderful version of Miser Lou. And his first record, I don't know how many people would remember that. His first hit record was a thing called Let's Go Surfing.
Because he's the surfing guitar.
We may have to dig that up a little later.
Okay.
And for people that wonder, well, what does this have to do with things automotive? Because Tom tests out the sound systems of the various vehicles that he is road testing with stuff like Dick Dale.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, can I jump in and share a partly personal that Johnny and I just found out about, and we think might be of interest to people who have recalls or that they're concerned about.
Oh, of course.
So I think most people know that we were some of the people that were affected by this Genesis GV80 recall. It was the fuel pipe leak recall.
And this was way back months ago that we were reading and hearing, and in fact, Tom reported that there was a recall.
So It was, I want to say, what, about a month and a half ago, we received a recall notice saying, yeah, there's been a recall. We'll let you know when we've got the fix. Okay, time passes. For whatever reason, we still haven't received any information saying, okay, we've got the fix. But about a week and a half ago, just on a whim, I decided to call the local dealership and say, hi, have you got a recall fix? And they said, sure, you want to bring your car in tomorrow?
Huh.
So we brought the car in. And with this particular recall, there are two levels. One is the, okay, you really need to have this whole thing replaced, and that's going to be kind of a several hour, like about a half a day fix or something, I guess. The other was the one that we fell under, which was, you really don't have a problem. Okay, we're going to tighten a few things, and an hour later, we're on our way home. Now, I mention this because I think more and more, as we're getting constant information about recalls, and sadly, reality is that a lot of the manufacturers, as much as they're trying to stay on top of this stuff, they're trying to get the information out to their dealerships. They may not get the information out to the individuals. Not a bad idea, if you've been waiting on a recall for a while, call your dealership. The worst they can say is, no, we don't have it yet, but you might get lucky like we did. And they said, yeah, bring it in tomorrow. We'll fix it.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering if you guys were the victims of just some clerical error, or if they were applying the recall in waves.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, yeah, it's interesting that you called the dealer and the dealer just knew.
Yeah. And we had called a couple of times over the past few months, and we don't have a fix yet. We don't know what the fix is going to be. And then we started hearing that people were leaving their cars for days to have it fixed. So we got very lucky, because they said, well, no, yours wasn't a problem. We checked everything.
Well, and what gave me the idea is, on one of the Facebook groups that I follow, I saw a couple people saying, oh, I just took my car in and had the recall. I thought, okay, well, then somebody has the recall. Yeah. Why don't I call our friendly local dealership and see what the deal is? And one other Genesis thing, not recall related. Did you see the news about the new Genesis that is scheduled to come out? I guess it's going to be even bigger than the GV80, and it's got what we used to call suicide doors.
I wasn't aware that the suicide doors were going to make production,
yes,
but
they are.
The bigger luxury SUV is a thing. So there's going to be the bigger Genesis vehicle, more comfortable for five or seven passengers. Audi too announced this week the details about the Q9, bigger than the Q7, about the size of the Genesis we're talking about. So we're starting to see these larger SUVs, somewhere between like a big Tahoe, or I should probably say Escalade, and their current largest vehicle in the lineup. But it's going to be in a weird position. We're going to be referring to crossovers, not SUVs, as large.
Yeah.
It's kind of a new segment.
But I forget the term they use. They didn't use the suicide doors, is a term that goes back to Lincoln, I think.
They were using Rolls-Royce doors.
Yes, because apparently there's only going to be one other vehicle. It's going to be either this new Genesis and Rolls-Royce that will have these kind of doors.
And when you say these kinds of doors, for those of us who don't know, these are doors that open the opposite way?
Exactly. So the front door will open the way front doors open. The rear door will open from the rear rather than from the B pillar.
The remember Lincoln did this as they got rid of the, said goodbye to the Continental for the last time, and they weren't able to do it without an actual B pillar. So the doors did open in that manner, but they did, for structural reasons or for rollover protection, did have to include a B pillar there. So it wasn't quite the wide open entry port we'd hoped it would be.
Well, I'm going to go back to Steve's explanation, though. Wouldn't the door open from the B pillar out versus from the back?
Well,
open.
Okay, I'm trying to think of what's the best way to explain this, Tom, because a front door opens. Okay, the hinge is close to the front fender.
Yeah.
Right.
And the door opens from the B pillar, but the hinge is on the front fender. The rear door, rather than the hinge being on the B pillar, the hinge is on the rear fender.
Oh, okay, that I understand.
So, yeah. So basically, both doors open up. They're opening and welcoming you in.
That's right. It's like you're opening
like,
your
like
arms.
Like saloon doors.
That's saloon right. Doors.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I like that.
They'll probably buy that instead of the suicide doors. And they were called that because what? When you open the
because
door?
Because sadly, a lot of people had accidents with the original version. So I'm wondering if with the new technology, if there will be beeps or something that will say, no, you shouldn't open because there's a car on the way.
Almost certainly. Because that technology now exists on other vehicles. Sure. But they were called suicide doors because the door opened behind you. And if a car came along and hit that door, you were in trouble.
Right. Of
Whereas
course.
If it hit the door in front of you, right. That would swing away.
But I maintain if I have a car that has Rolls-Royce doors, I've got somebody opening the door for me. I have people.
Good point.
You know, I don't need to worry about those things. Tom Appel is our guest. Tom, we're going to take a break. Forbes reported some pretty startling news about recalls. I couldn't believe this. The first half of the year, over 23 million vehicles were affected. This is just the first half of 2026. 23 million vehicles affected by recalls. Ford leads the surge, accounting for 52% of the light-duty recalls with over 12 million vehicles. And this increase, they say, stems from greater vehicle complexity, rapid development, stricter regulatory scrutiny. Recalls ensure public safety. They present an inconvenience. We talk about that every time Tom is on the show with us. Not necessarily a bad thing. That means they're trying to stay on top of these things. So.
Yeah.
The latest news. Tom Appel is our guest. We'll come right back here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. I love this. This is a great cartoons theme that Tom Appel has. Tom, who is that and what is that?
That is the California Guitar Trio. They've been around for a while. Off their album Yamanashi Blues, and that cut's called Blockhead. And their albums are wonderful, wonderful mixtures of original music and really fantastic covers. And they cover a lot of surf stuff too, mm-hmm. with their really interesting sound. Wonderful band if you're interested in just like really good guitar playing.
Yeah, I've got some of their albums. They do some terrific stuff. By the way, before we jump back into recalls and all kinds of things, there was one story that just, really surprised me. You want to jump into this Porsche story?
Yeah, this is interesting for a bunch of reasons. And it seems sudden, but it's probably not. Porsche, German sports car maker Porsche, got itself in some trouble. And that trouble is far deeper and broader and I think more far-reaching than anyone could possibly appreciate. But the car maker, which has been growing for years, for decades, selling more and more cars in the U.S., doing well in Europe, but most recently making tons and tons of money in China, is now in trouble. And one of the problems that they have, apart from declining sales here in the U.S., is the fact that the Chinese population no longer wants to buy vehicles from non-domestic makers. They don't want General Motors, Ford, Volkswagens, cars like that. And they really don't want premium cars from outside of the country. And Porsche sales have declined by about a third in China in just the last couple of years. So Porsche's got trouble. They have overcapacity. They have declining profits. They spent a lot of money on electric vehicles that money isn't returning, you know, any revenue right now. Mm-hmm. So Porsche is looking to drop 9,000 people of its 40,000 person workforce.
Wow.
Yeah. Over time, they want to do it through attrition. They don't want to lay them off. But this is the kind of thing we're seeing from Mercedes. And I think we've talked about the fact that Volkswagen is in similar dire straits, and they're looking to fire about 100,000 workers in Germany. Yeah, these European makers are really struggling right now.
And this really doesn't have well, maybe some of it has to do with computers taking over some of the jobs, but it's not everything to do with computers taking over the jobs, right?
No, automation is a problem. But part of the problem, too, is that demand for the cars has slowly slipped. And you could do a deep dive into that if you wanted to. Porsche only sells a small number of 911s. It's traditional sports cars. So what the brand is sort of difficult to easily summarize. They sell an awful lot of crossovers and just a few sports cars. So I think the brand's getting a little bit watered down with time. They just dropped their two small cars, the Boxster and the Cayman. So yeah, it's a confusing time, I think, for Porsche. And this contraction, the shrinking, probably going to be where they stay for a while after this.
What is this doing to, if you say that China as a whole is not looking favorably on foreign manufacturers, what is this doing to General Motors, specifically Buick, which for years had a reputation as being one of the cars of choice? Because wasn't it one of the Chinese emperors that had driven a Buick years ago or something like that, and that was part of the legacy?
Yes, actually, I think that comes up in the movie The Last Emperor. But yeah, Buick was beloved in China. But yeah, General Motors products just not doing well over there. General Motors product sales in China have fallen by about half
wow.
in the last 5 years. Yeah.
Because wasn't there one point not all that long ago where China was one of the largest sales sources for General Motors?
Yeah, they were doing really well there, and Buick was super successful. And the Buick lineup in China was way bigger than it is here. They had small sedans, mid-sized sedans, minivans. They had all sorts of stuff over there that we didn't get because it was just there was just such a market for it. But they General Motors bought Cadillac over there, which did well for a little while. They were selling Chevy there. I don't think they use the Chevy brand over there anymore, and they still have their their joint venture partner, SAIC. So General Motors sells an awful lot of cars we don't recognize that are very much smaller than American market cars.
What are you driving these days?
I am in, at the moment, the Lexus LX600. Mm-hmm. And that is Lexus's largest SUV. It's a body-on-frame big rig. So it competes more or less with something like the Cadillac Escalade or Lincoln Navigator. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit smaller than those, a little bit tidier. Handles well. I love the noisy exhaust makes. But this is a very nice car, and it's very expensive. The test car I am in, I've got the window sticker right here, $110,000.
Hello.
Wow. Wow.
Okay, I have to ask. You love the noise the exhaust makes. Is it real exhaust noise, or is this, I pick this kind of exhaust noise?
That's a very good question, and I tend to kind of bristle against fake exhaust noise. This one might be real. It's just a gentle burble, but I like to hear it on acceleration, and then it goes away on the highway. So it's not a nuisance sound. You just get some sense of acceleration, which is nice because this is a pretty refined and quiet car. So I'm gonna call the exhaust noise like MSG. It just sort of enhances the experience.
It won't kill you, but it just makes it better. At $100,000+, after you've spent some time in this Lexus, what gives it an edge over others in that category?
I'm going to give it big points for traditional Lexus build quality.
Okay.
Everything just seems really solid.
So
well
great
put together.
Fits and finishes, no wind noise. If you had any rattling, you'd be like, really, at $110,000? What's rattling? It'd be like my empty pockets, if anything.
Oh, that would be so frustrating. Yes. Also, I would argue that it's certainly got the best ride handling balance. It's surprisingly nimble for its size, and the power is great too.
Now, of course, if you're going to pay over $100,000, you're probably not terribly worried about the cost of gasoline. But I have to ask, what's the gas mileage on that?
Well, after I drove around today, I was at 17.8 mpg. A little bit disappointing, and I believe it requires premium fuel.
Of course it does.
Yeah, it's a little expensive. The feed and care of this vehicle, a little more expensive than some vehicles.
The feed and
again,
care.
Rear wheel, all wheel, front wheel, what?
They are all wheel drive. That's standard.
So are we seeing, it sounds like we are, I guess I'm answering my own question, the pendulum is swinging toward larger vehicles as opposed to let's downsize because of the cost of gasoline and let's be thinking about the future of the world. It seems like the big guys are getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, Lexus doesn't move a bunch of these. And people might remember that the previous generation LX was really a clone of the Toyota Land Cruiser.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when they redesigned both of those vehicles, I think for 2025, the Land Cruiser changed a lot. It got smaller, a little more off-road oriented, and less luxurious, and much more affordable. The Land Cruiser used to cost almost this much money, and now it starts closer to 60 grand. So they've given that a different mission. So this is going to sell better, I think, moving forward, because there's no internal competition anymore.
Wow. We're talking cars. Talma Pill joins us a couple times a month to do just that. So stay with us. News is next here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putnam at WGN Radio. We're talking all things automotive with Tom Appel, the publisher of Consumer Guide, and that's one of Tom's tunes. And Tom, if you keep coming up with stuff like this, we may never get to talk because I want to let these things play. So who was that and what was that? I love it.
That was Matt Guitar Murphy off his album Way Down South from 1990. And that cut's called Matt's Guitar Boogie Number 2.
That's so good.
You were jamming to that stuff when Tom sent it.
How did you stumble on that? That's some great stuff.
I want to say that I was cleaning up at a Borders store when they were going out of business. And that's how I got the California Guitar Trio and the Matt Guitar Murphy CDs.
That's good. Yeah.
Some good stuff.
Okay. Let's go back to recalls, because I've got a really weird story for you, Tom.
Okay.
The Mercedes recall.
Yeah.
Have you followed this one? 310,000 Mercedes will be recalled.
It's interesting because what's being recalled is not something that's on every car.
Okay.
They called it a micro switch, and it's built into the door lock on the car, into the door handle. And basically, on a premium car like this, there's a bunch of things that happen when you open the door, but the car may not realize that the door has been opened. And that's because the switch itself has corroded. But one of the important things that happens is when you open the car on a Mercedes, and there's a bunch of cars involved in this recall, it immediately puts the car, engages the parking brake. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to do that. That happens automatically. But in these cars, that may not be happening because the switch has corroded.
That's crazy. So the recall is for the door switch, but the problem is the brakes may not kick in, the parking brake.
Yeah, I think the actual incidence of any sort of negative occurrence is probably ultra low because this is really like a backup system. It's an additional safety system. But if they offer it, they should really be standing behind it.
Well, yeah, and if you count on it, if you park your vehicle and you think that's one of the things a vehicle does, and you walk away from your vehicle and the parking brake has not engaged as you thought it would, because the door lock is corroded, that just doesn't compute in my head. I'm like, it seems like they worked hard to make that happen.
So they got a 300,000. They're all small cars, A-class, B-class, and C-class vehicles, both cars and crossovers.
Mm.
By the way, I wanted just for a second before we move on, I want to address the elephant on the internet. If you're trying to go to consumerguide.com right now, as happens with every website every now and then, you ain't going to be able to do that. Sometimes the demons of cyberspace just decide, I don't want to work. And is that the technical term for what's going on tonight, Tom?
That is exactly what it is.
Okay. Yes.
And that's the voice I use every time I call my tech guy.
Yeah.
We should be up pretty soon, but yeah, it's super irritating. It's got something to do with GoDaddy. So we're working on it. I apologize.
Okay. We're talking about suicide doors or Rolls-Royce doors, and we have a listener who is a car guy, 872 area code, and he sent along not only some information about those doors, but pictures from ads from the 60s. Lincoln had suicide doors from 61 through 67, and the Thunderbird four-door Landau had them from 67 into 71.
Always forget about that Thunderbird. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh.
The first four-door Thunderbird.
And you would love this because he does send the original ads for these, like the Thunderbird. I'm like, the woman's got the biggest hair. I don't know how she even got in the car with hair that big. And, you know, she's sitting in the back seat because, of course, she's got those doors. So she's got somebody to open the door for her to get into the back seat of the vehicle. Listeners, let me grab this one. This is a question about solar panels. Tom, have you come across any information about possibly the use of solar panels? Let's see how he phrases it. Give me a second here. Is anyone exploring solar panel use on EVs and hybrids? That comes from Jim G.
We have seen solar panels built into the roof of a few vehicles, most famously the Fisker Karma, which goes way back to about the launch of the Tesla Model S in 2011. And at the time, the panels didn't do much to extend range. Mm-hmm. They simply couldn't collect a meaningful amount of energy. Now, around that time, Ford was putting together a package for the Ford Focus EV, a vehicle that was not sold in the Chicago area. It was mostly a California compliance vehicle, where they were selling a complete outfit, like a lean-to, that you could set up in your driveway that would collect energy to charge your car with. But that would take some time, and you'd have to gather the energy over the course of a day.
Well, no, we actually experienced that at the college that we consult with and that we broadcast from down in Florida, Gulf Coast State College. They built a vehicle that was solar powered, and we got to drive it, and it was really cool. And because
we were two of, I think, like seven people that ever got to drive it. Sadly, it was destroyed during Hurricane Michael.
Yeah, it came through and destroyed it. But they were able to take advantage of Florida sunshine and just park it under these solar panels. And there were solar panels on the vehicle itself. And it was really kind of weirdly cool. You know?
It's really cool. There's a lot of practical issues with that. One, you've got to shape the roof of the car to kind of catch the light.
Yeah.
And if you follow the contour of the roof of a normal design vehicle, you know, something like a half or two thirds of the solar cells are not going to be optimally located to catch the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem. Also, solar cells need to be replaced over time, 15 or 20 years. So that would limit the life cycle of the vehicle a little bit, too.
One of the really wonderful things about the whole program that they were trying to implement at the college was their goal was to perfect this so that they could go to third world countries and they could take a vehicle from the States, give it to this country, and then set it up with solar panels so that they wouldn't have to worry about gasoline, so that they could drive down to the water and, you know, get buckets of water and then drive back to their village.
Because Tom Hoots, who designed this, was telling us that they, I forget which part of Africa it was, but they had to walk literally 40 miles a day carrying buckets.
Yeah, the round trip.
To get water.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And his whole point was if you design this car and we'll give it to them.
Yeah.
And let them just use this. They won't have to worry about filling it up with gas.
They were even to the point where the college was talking to some of the big, like a GMC, you know, a General Motors, a Ford, to see if they would make vehicles available that the school would then set up as solar vehicles and then get them over to these countries.
In fact, if you want to see a little more information on this, go to our blog. That's stephenjohnny.wordpress.com. Do a search for Tom Hoots, T TOMHOOTS. And a blog that we did about Tom a few years ago will come up, and you will see pictures of this vehicle. And he actually, he was ready to offer the design to whoever wanted to use it.
Yeah, he said, I'll give them everything absolutely free. If like a Ford stepped in and said, we love this idea, I would give them the specs. And then it was just really exciting, and it's just terrible that the hurricane came through and just destroyed all of the evidence of all their hard work that they'd put into it.
Yeah, you will also, you'll see a picture of this. Sadly, you'll see a picture after it was destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we take a break, a listener says, as we were talking about recalls and the time it takes to get your vehicle repaired, he has a Ford F-150, and he said they came to my house to do a software fix, and it took them 10 minutes. They were in and out of my house and took care of it. So it's great news.
I need to write about that. Mobile service is a thing that's on the rise.
Oh, yes. Boy, is it.
And increases in recalls are the perfect reason for dealers to invest in these mobile vans.
Well, again, I'll take you back to Florida. There's a service that has come, and I don't know how this would fly in Chicago, but they will come to your house and fill your car with gas. If you don't have time to stop at the gas station, they will come and fill it for you for a fee, of course. And then in the morning when you go out to head to work, you don't have to stop at the gas station. You don't have to worry about it.
And there's all kinds of mobile repair services.
And car wash. They come to your house and wash your car.
Detail your car.
They've got traveling mechanics that come around, which people love that idea where, you know, you're actually looking at your car in your own driveway while somebody comes and works on it, and you can pick their brains while they're doing it. And the prices are really pretty reasonable, too.
By the way, just before we break, that we've been talking a little bit about like the Lincoln suicide doors and stuff, and it all stemmed from a story we were talking about, Genesis. And I found the original story, and I sent Johnny a copy of it. It's a car and driver story that apparently originally appeared in the British publication Car, and a Genesis executive confirmed that the GV90 will feature what they call coach doors. And it will not, there's a picture of it, and there is no B-pillar.
Interesting.
So, I will send you a link to it too, Tom.
First question is, how does that affect the crash worthiness of a vehicle without that B-pillar?
Particularly since Genesis has been so active in making sure that their vehicles are really some of the safest, as close to crash-proof vehicles that you can get. What were you going to say, Tom?
Oh, I was going to say that Tiger Woods proved that for us.
Right.
Exactly.
He was in the GV80.
Yeah.
He was, you know, probably saved by that vehicle.
And flipped. Didn't he flip a couple of times?
He did roll over, and ultimately there was some front offset impact that I think it did break his feet, but he was lucky.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. All right. We'll take a break. Tom Appel is our guest. We're talking, if you hadn't guessed, about cars here on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. That is one of Tom's car tunes. Tonight's theme, that's good guitar. And Tom, I'm going to take a wild guess and say that was not a digital recording in stereo.
You are correct, sir. Yeah, that recording goes back to 1929. That was Blind Blake, and the song was Blind Arthur's Breakdown.
That's fun.
And I love that feel.
If you're looking for Blind Blake music, you're going to find out that there's like 8 albums out there, all with the exact same 7 songs. They're just...
Yep.
There aren't that many recordings, unfortunately,
really?
And the quality never gets better than what we just heard.
And Tom knows because he has all 7 of those albums.
I do have a couple.
But it's fun to listen, and you realize, okay, no overdubbing, no nothing. Yeah. I mean, this is just what he was doing, and even all these many years later, it still sounds fun.
It sounds kind of modern to me, too, when you take away the static and the kind of the echo, but it sounds surprisingly contemporary.
By the way, if you check your email, Tom, I just sent you a link to the GV90 we were talking about.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, there's a weird story that's getting some mileage, especially on Facebook, where weird stories go to die or to live, as, as is the case with this
or
one.
Or to populate.
Yeah, this is the story about Stellantis mandating that if trucks drove over the Gordie Howe International Bridge, that they would be fined. Mm-hmm. And so when you read that, you say, oh, that's outrageous. Why are they doing this? This seems so wrong. So, Tom, we brought this to your attention. What did you learn? Because I learned quite a bit about this.
This is a crazy story, and it's super interesting. Apparently, Stellantis, back when they were Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, FCA, had put together a deal, and it was quite a good deal for FCA at the time, for their vehicles to pay a discounted rate traveling over the Ambassador Bridge. This is back before the Gordie Howe Bridge opened. We should mention that the Gordie Howe Bridge is this new wonderful bridge from Windsor to Detroit, or Detroit to Windsor, really easing up traffic on the other bridge that was just always backed up. But they had a deal in place, and it's pretty expensive to cross that bridge. And they were getting a discount, and apparently FCA was paying something like $400,000 or $500,000 a year in tolls. Yeah. And they got some deal put together with the folks that ran the Ambassador Bridge to knock that down to like a third of that. Mm-hmm. So they're still under contract to do that. So they're getting the deal, and they don't want to violate the contract. So for now, the truck drivers running these FCA vehicles in either direction there are required to still use the Ambassador Bridge.
So on one hand, they will have a much longer wait, but on the other hand, a much cheaper toll.
But they may not have a longer wait because the other vehicles are going over to the Gordie Howe Bridge. And the headline, I looked at the story at half a dozen different places, and the headline is really misleading because it makes Stellantis look like the bad guys in this. It makes them look like that they are just kind of putting their hands on their hips and saying, don't do that. Don't let the Canadians. And it all comes down to the union and the agreement that they made with the other bridge. And when they're saying, as I understand it and from what I read, once that contract is up, then the drivers will be free to go over to the new Gordie Howe Bridge. But if you see this story and people get all lathered up about it, especially when it comes on social media.
Aren't they technically free to do that now if they choose to pay higher?
They'll be fined if they do that.
Okay.
The drivers will be fined if they find out that they're not using the contracted Ambassador Bridge. Did you follow that too, Tom? That's what I learned.
Yes, because they committed to doing business with the Ambassador Bridge.
Okay, so
I forgot for the length of the contract. It's not much longer.
No, I think it's the end of summer. The end of summer is going to be up. But why this is getting so much mileage, is it just because the new Gordie Howe Bridge opened?
Probably.
Finally,
But it makes unions look bad. And at first glance, it looks like a lot of the stories on social media are what's called rage bait. You read the headline, you don't read the story, and you go, what? That's outrageous. Yeah. And then you start typing away before you read the story. Because frankly, I did that when I first read the story. Mm-hmm. I sent it to you, Steve. I sent it to Tom. And then I started reading. And I went, wait a minute. They have a contract.
Yeah, the headlines were terrible.
Yeah.
Also, the cost, it costs $75 to drive an 18-wheeler over that bridge.
Wow. Well, that's what it's like to drive over the Skyway. What's $75? No, seriously.
And didn't the Skyway just go up again?
We were leaving Northwest Indiana last week after the storm, and we were concerned about maybe some flooding on the Bishop Ford, for example, and said, well, we'll take the Skyway. And I put it in my GPS, and it said, that would be a $13 trip. And I went, nah, I think we'll just be going the Bishop Ford.
And from where we would be getting on the Skyway and getting off, it would be roughly the same amount of time, give or take a minute or two.
Yeah, for $13.
Yeah. Mm. And we want to do that. Why?
Why? That's what we said. Why?
So what else is on your radar we haven't talked about, Tom?
Wow, what's going on that's interesting? I just drove the Lucid Gravity which is Lucid's second vehicle, a vehicle they desperately need. And it's a nice car, but it did suffer from some strange glitches.
Which were?
I was accelerating away from a light, and all of a sudden there was no throttle response.
Ooh.
I looked at the dashboard, and I got a warning light that my hood was open, and I needed to pull over and close my hood. The hood was not open. Turning off the car and restarting the car fixed everything, but that was weird. And that same thing happened to me another time, unrelated to the hood, but where I lost throttle response. So frustrating.
Yeah.
That's something I think we should throw out, because so many times you will get a warning light or something, and there are so many computer components in today's automobiles. Like you would do with the computer, pull over, turn the computer / car off, let it sit for about 30 seconds, open and close the door in a lot of cases, and then turn it back on, and the problem will go away. Not all the time, but a significant amount of the time. Would you agree, Tom?
Yeah, no, this has happened to me in other brands, too. I remember I had a BMW completely lock up on me. Every dashboard light went on, and the car cruised to a stop. And I was like, oh, this is going to ruin my weekend. And turned the car off, turned it back on. Everything was fine. Never had the problem again.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. You never know what kind of weird software hiccup. Hitting Control-Alt-Delete seems to fit.
Yes. And that's basically what you're doing.
And
yeah,
opening,
it really is.
Opening the door and closing the door is basically telling it this is a fresh start.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hmm.
You're rebooting your car.
Reboot this, right? What was the latest on your podcast for folks who want to tune into that?
Oh, we had a good conversation with Jamie Butters. Jamie Butters is the one-time managing editor over at Automotive News. He now has his own podcast called Autotown. But he joined us to talk about where we were with tariffs and electric vehicles and things of that nature. But it's a great conversation. Jamie has a great deal to say about those things, and he's super well-informed and really worth hearing. So that podcast is live now.
And I bet that Mr. Butters is a smooth talker.
Oh.
You know,
indeed he is.
You know he got grief when he was in school. You know,
oh,
there was
sure.
All kinds of he's toast. We got to butter him. You know, ouch.
I'm sure.
And while Tom's website is not playing nice with any of us right now, if people want to find out all kinds of interesting automotive stuff, they should go to consumerguide.com.
Please
and,
do.
And follow you on Blue Sky, Car Guy Tom, and any place else?
Yep. And I'm also on Facebook if people want to check that out. I talk less about cars and more about classic TV on Facebook.
You do. I love it.
Especially Rockford Files.
Especially Rockford Files and Gunsmoke. I love Gunsmoke.
Yes. We do too. So I can bond when I go to. And I love the old ads that you also post.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, as always, for your time, Tom. We will talk to you. Welcome to August, another month.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
We'll take a break. News is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. Love Ella Langley. She has been breaking records like crazy, and with that particular song, Choosin' Texas, it now has surpassed Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, Mariah Carey's We Belong Together, Debbie Boone's You Light Up My Life, logging in a record-setting 15 weeks
at the top of Billboard's top 100 singles charts. And you notice that did not say Billboard's country charts.
No.
So it's crossed over, and that doesn't always happen. I mean, you can have a great deal of success on the country charts and then maybe get a little airplay. But, boy, this thing, for a 27-year-old, I feel like she just kind of popped up one day. And
she's been working hard for a while.
Yeah.
And if you have seen, there are two different videos. One is just the song video, which runs 3 minutes-ish. Seek out the longer video, which is closer to 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is a movie.
It is absolutely wonderful. And as I understand, she had to fight the record company to get that done.
I don't know if she'll be fighting anymore after breaking all the records. I came across a great story in American Songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
It's online. It used to be an actual print magazine. Right. But they did a story about four moments that explain her popularity. And one of the moments was because of her song Loving Life Again is about mental health, mm-hmm. being open about mental health. Yeah, that would kind of get your attention, you know, for a young woman. Loving Life Again was her story to tell in her dedication to discussing her own mental health struggles with fans. She said, "I'm just not going to hide that. Mm-hmm. It's part of my inspiration. It's part of who I am." One of the other reasons why we should love her is her hilarious fitness themed Be Her parody. And I haven't seen the video of the Be Her parody, but apparently it's very funny. And I have seen this video of her doing a duet with a 7-year-old fan. It's the sweetest thing you will ever see. This child will remember this forever. And it's 7. Yeah, mm-hmm. You remember things that happened to you when you were 7. But this transcends all of the other memories from when you were 7 years old. She's on stage singing her little heart out. And Ella Langley is just kind of, yeah, we got this, girl. Mm-hmm. We can sing this. And the other one was her humble ACM Artist of the Year speech. And we did see that.
Yeah.
And she was up there weeping and looking amazing. And yeah. She does get some criticism because in her video, she does a bit of drinking and smoking.
Yeah.
People are saying, wait, you're trying to appeal to this younger audience, like these 7-year-old fans,
yeah.
and you're drinking and smoking, and that's kind of, you know, a problem. We got to talk about that, Ella.
Yeah.
So she's
a force.
She's the name for the summer of 2026.
Yeah, absolutely. What a talent.
There was an opinion piece in the Tribune today. Chicago's rock and roll summer of 1966 was culturally transcendent. And it's an opinion piece in the Trib written by a retired attorney. And he is a local guy because he is a graduate of Oak Park High School. And it's funny, the year 1966 is popping up tonight.
Because we were talking about earlier, the Bobby Fuller Four.
Yeah, and your anniversary as a broadcaster, as a professional broadcaster. And this piece is all about, you know, what was happening in 1966 in Chicago, mm-hmm. and how we had so much music. And the opinion piece was brought to my attention by Carl Giammarisi of the Buckinghams.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are mentioned in this piece about how music was just so special in Chicago in 1966.
And there were so many Chicago groups that were at the top of the not only the local charts, but the national charts.
Right. And Carl invites Michael to come out to next Saturday night show in Carpentersville. Be our guest. Come. Not only will you see the Buckinghams perform at 6:30 mm-hmm. in the evening, but at 8 o'clock, you'll see the Ides of March with Jim Peterik.
Mm-hmm.
Both bands mentioned in Michael Paragon's piece in the Tribune. So it'll be fun to see if he takes them up on that offer to come join us. Find out what music is like today.
Well, and one of the cool things about both of those groups in particular is that they are still relevant. They don't do Las Vegas versions.
No.
They do their songs. And Jim Peterik with the Ides of March, he's still, in fact, we got to get Jim back on because he just came out with a new album with the Pride of Lions, which is a group that he's been very, it's a duo
mm-hmm.
that he's been very successful with over in Europe. And they just came out with another album that I believe is pretty much at
That's
the top
Jim
of the charts.
And Toby.
Oh, I can't think of Toby's last name. It's horrible. Hitchcock?
Hitchcock. Yes, yes. We have them both in studio performing. And Toby.
Wonderful.
We could have put Toby.
Wow.
on Michigan Avenue when he was performing on our show because
we didn't need microphones for him.
He has an arena rock voice. Yep. I mean, he will just blow the roof off the joint. It's just amazing. But, you know, back to what's happening next weekend, it's Jamboree Days. Makes you think it's going to be all country music out in Carpentersville. But on Friday at night at 4:30, it's a Scuba Kin. At 5:30, it's the Mike Wheeler Band. At 7:30, it's the Outfit. At 9 o'clock, it's Buck Cherry. And then on Saturday at 2 o'clock, it's Sparks Fly, followed by Losing It. It's spelled L-E-W-Z-I-N-I-T. At 6:30, it's the Buckinghams. And 8 o'clock, it's the Ides of March featuring Jim Peterik. We're going to take a break and come right back here. We're in the final hour of the show on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. That was a dealer's choice. And Jonathan, why? I love it, but why?
Well, I actually had this one planned for last week because, you know, a road or car themed with your traffic jam situation.
Oh,
okay.
However,
yeah,
this is topical this evening because of the ice cream the ice cream conversation, and I'll explain.
Right.
There was a film in the 80s called Maximum Overdrive.
Yes.
By Stephen King.
Yes.
Based on one of his books.
Yeah.
The one of the possessed vehicles in that film was an ice cream truck, and it was playing King of the Road.
That's minutia. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
The map in your mind is
well, it just
wonderful.
It
I love it.
It worked out perfectly twofold in this particular instance.
I was trying to think, why? Is this the anniversary of the song being released? Is Jonathan buying a trailer? He's going to be living in the parking lot? it's a good song, though.
It's one of my top karaoke songs. I love it.
Is it really?
Because I can sing in that range. Like,
okay.
It is. It's perfect for me.
Are you a musician?
I'm not. I dabble. I play with instruments and I own instruments, but I would not consider myself a musician. But
you have the heart of a musician.
Of course. I'm a music lover and I can kind of kill it at karaoke. I'm not going to lie. Not to toot my own horn or anything.
But it ain't bragging if you done it.
Exactly.
You're following in your father's footsteps, right?
100%.
Yes.
How much are you into Roger Miller?
Not a ton, actually. When I was, like, I've listened to the song plenty of times, and there was another song I'd not ever heard of. But what is it? You Can't Roller Skate in a Herd?
Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd.
Yes, there you go. So, and then
have you ever heard Dang Me?
I've not heard Dang Me.
Dig up Dang Me.
I will dig
Roger
up Dang
Miller.
Me.
You can go ahead and that's your assignment while we're talking.
Yes.
Dang Me, ought to take a rope and hang me. High from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
Always wanted to talk to Roger Miller. I would have had a hard time talking to him, though, because I was a huge fan. It would be one of those classic, I was fangirling and, you know, couldn't really have to carry on a coherent conversation. Da, da, yeah, yeah. And you're cute, too. I'd probably say something stupid like that.
You got Dang Me?
I do. I have it up.
Okay, hit it. That's Roger Miller. That is a recut version of Dang Me. That's not the original.
I'll have to.
You amaze me when you go, whoa, why are they playing that one? That's not the original.
Well, it's not.
I will have to research the original, but the theme I get from him is he has a very silly lyrical influence.
What was the song? Oh, I'm trying to think. It wasn't Dang Me. He needed money. He walked into his publisher's office. He asked for an advance, and the publisher said, I'm sorry, I can't give you an advance unless you got a new song. He walked out, came back an hour later. He'd written a song that became his next hit record.
Yeah.
He was just, his mind was just and crazy good.
Lyrically, when you really listen to his songs, they were poetry.
Oh, absolutely.
It was a little bit like a Chuck Berry. When you read the lyrics of a Chuck Berry song, you realize, wow, there was some poetry going on there with some great hook lines, too.
In the song with the roller skate, you can't
roller skate in the buffalo herd.
There is a nonsensical line that I recognized and I never knew what it was from. In the television show The Office, Andy Bernard constantly has this line. He says, "Rit-it-it-it-do." And as I was listening to that other song that you'd mentioned,
you can't roller skate.
You can't roller skate in a herd of elephants?
No, buffalo.
Buffalo herd. That's a refrain, and immediately that piqued my brain. I was like, oh, that's where that's from. So it's an Easter egg. Had no idea it was a reference.
You know, I've just decided that you have a mind that webs. You're like, you know how you're on the internet and one thing leads you to another thing, leads you to another thing, and you fall down that rabbit hole and you're just like, woo, I've been here for 2 hours. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's kind of how your mind is working. You're webbing all over the place. It shoots over here and it comes back over there and it takes you to the middle and it takes you back to the left.
Oh, I'm like Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas. I'm like, what's this? What's this?
Squirrel.
There you go again.
Exactly.
Oh, we're getting to know Jonathan, our producer.
Whether you're ready or not.
That's right. Listener says, to quote the great Spike Odell, you ain't getting this kind of radio up and down the dial.
Very, very true.
Perfect. Love it.
Yes. And the listener from 847 said, the music is great. Enjoy it. Oh, I love this one from 847. Remember last week we were talking about Afternoon Delight, and it was the 50th anniversary of Afternoon Delight, and I, as a baby radio announcer, did not realize that there was some deep meaning to Afternoon Delight. I just thought since I was on in the afternoon, I could be a delight. She writes, and I'm assuming it's a she said, for 50 years, I thought Afternoon Delight was about fireworks on 4th of July.
Well, yeah, maybe.
In a way.
Depending on your definition of fireworks.
She said, why would I think anything else? Exactly. That's what I
Because the line was skyrockets in flight.
Yeah.
Oh, good point.
Afternoon Delight.
Here we go.
Yep.
Here we go. Which brings me to stroking.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yes.
It's that time of the night.
So, the White Sox are using, because of Muna's love of the Clarence Carter song, Stroking. Mm-hmm. It's become their theme. Now they have a handshake, Jonathan, which includes the stroking as they're slapping hands.
Isn't it... Muno and Mike Vassell.
Mike Vassell. Yeah. It's like a 15-step handshake.
There's a video, and I think the camera may have been, maybe Mike was holding the camera or something, because you see Muno come up to him, and they start doing this whole routine.
And then they stroke in, and then the rest of the team kind of, and I said to you, how sad that this song is really getting legs because of their popularity, and Clarence Carter died just a couple months ago and did not get to realize this renewed popularity. And I hope his estate benefits from this somehow, some way.
I think they do anytime the song is played.
But that doesn't count for every time the guys sing it in the dugout, you know.
Yeah, to have a sports team celebrate your song, come up with handshakes and sing your song, like that type of revelry, that just warms the heart.
Absolutely. My favorite White Sox story today was, of course, they did not win. They were shut out, but it was only 1-0. So I get over that. The fact that they're playing Tampa Bay and the mascot for Tampa Bay is a character named Raymond, because they're the Tampa Bay Rays.
Right.
Raymond had the nerve to come out on the field and taunt the White Sox today wearing a cape and a wizard's hat with a wand.
I love it.
Don't do that. That is all White Sox. And Mike Vassell was like, no, get out of here. And look what happened. They lost.
Yeah.
That dang Raymond, big blue furry thing.
What is the day that the Sox are doing, and everybody, the first like 15,000 or something get a wands.
Oh, that's cool.
What is? Oh, that,
they're going to get wands, and then there's going to be the mitre day when everybody shows up. Everybody will get a Pope mitre.
Yeah,
that they can wear.
I did hear that those tickets sold out incredibly fast, but I think everybody in the stadium is getting one. If I'm not mistaken,
yes. Yeah.
It's not just like the first 10,000.
They're not going to say only Catholics get a mitre. Everybody gets a mitre, which is going to make a great scene when the guys take off their shirts when they do tarps off, because that's mm-hmm. another thing that they do. Have you heard about that?
Not really.
Okay. It usually happens in one of the last innings.
Right. And so there will be a whole group of guys that get in the upper stands and they all take their shirts off and it's called tarps off. And that's
yes,
when
I'm
they're
aware
cheering
of that phenomena that started. Yes. I was not aware that the White Sox were partaking.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The Sox have been doing it, well, most of the summer.
Yes, yes. Tarps off.
Oh, that's been a big sports yeah. phenomena. And like even the ladies are getting involved.
No!
We're wearing sports bras. They're being, they're wearing, you know, they're not getting kicked out of the stadium for it, but to see yes. everybody get involved in that type yes. of celebration and revelry, that's just yes. cool.
Just keep your pants on.
That, oh, yeah.
That only happens at Lollapalooza. That's where you lose your pants. We got to take a break for news right now on WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman at WGN Radio. I love that song. That is Chad Elliott. We met him... how many years ago? We were promoting our Les Paul book, and we were Lily Kuzma's guest on DCB.
Right.
And he happened to be her other guest that night.
It was probably 12 years ago.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
And Chad is touring now. He's with, he's doing some solo stuff, but also...
he's part of a duet.
What is the... oh, I can't... that, something Ramblings. The wave...
from Iowa.
Yeah.
He is a amazing artist.
Oh, boy.
Painter. Ooh, his stuff is, he's got a style like no one else. And my goal is to one day own a Chad Elliott yeah. work of art.
Yeah. Look him up. Chad yeah. Elliott. I think it's ChadElliott.com or ChadElliottMusic.com. He is so talented. We have to get him back on the show.
He's just a shadow of his former self.
Yeah.
He's lost, I think, 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And he posted a picture just the other day, his before and after. It's like, whoa, wow. You kind of sort of look like a guy named Chad Elliott, maybe a distant relative or something.
I'm showing ChadElliott.net here.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's just, he's so talented. And hopefully he's going to be back in the Chicago area at some yeah. point.
Well, speaking of talent, last Saturday night, we spent an hour and a half with this mm-hmm. delightful human being that we had not met before. You had come across her because Facebook knows that you have friends in Nashville,
yeah.
and she was moving from Nashville to Chicago. You reached out to her after listening to her music and said, wow, she is a great singer-songwriter.
Alice Wallace.
Alice Wallace was in here with us, and we got great buzz. People said, whoa, who was that woman? Amazing voice, great songwriter, but she's also a yodeler.
Mm-hmm.
And she joined us to talk about the yodeling symposium that she was doing at the Old Town School of Folk Music on Saturday morning.
We found out during the week that apparently it had been so successful, they had to move it to a bigger room.
Right, to accommodate all the people who wanted to come and learn about yodeling. And I think she was having a pinch me moment, like,
yeah.
Because when she was in here with us, she was kind of chuckling like, well, we hope that people will come out and you don't have to know how to yodel, but you'll get the history of yodeling and I'll demonstrate for you. Well, surprise, surprise, Chicago wanted to know more about yodeling. And she had a wonderful turnout, and she said on her Facebook page that she's feeling more and more like a Chicagoan after
good.
Spending Saturday morning with all these terrific people who came out to see her at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
And we just heard from Julian, our official videographer, and he is working on some videos from Alice's performance last week. And he's just completed a couple videos of the Empty Pockets doing some new songs the last time they were on with us. So hopefully those videos will make their way. I just realized, if you saw my face kind of glaze over, I just realized we never posted Patrick's technology notes from last week's show. It's been one of those weeks.
Yeah, we were in Indiana for your birthday, and those horrible storms rolled through on Monday. Jonathan, where were you when the storms hit the area on Monday?
I was at home watching a movie.
Oh, it was scary. I mean, I've never been in a town like we were in Munster where the sirens came on and they just ran for the longest time.
And the sirens were going off and on for about 2 hours.
Every 15 minutes. Yeah. And they would just stay on for like 3 to 5 minutes. And I thought, am I going crazy? Or maybe it was less than 3 to 5 minutes, but it felt like an eternity. It was so scary.
That does seem like an excessive amount of time. But I mean, longer than not at all.
But the tornadoes were headed that way. Yep. So it was not a tornado. It was a warning.
And fortunately, we didn't have any tornadoes in our immediate area, but not too far from us in Lansing.
Yes. Boy, they Lansing did. And Hazelcrest. Yeah. As I said earlier, I was just looking at the explanation of the, I think it was 7 tornadoes. In fact, the state of Illinois now is ranked at the top of the states that have the most tornadoes.
Instead of Oklahoma. What's wrong with that picture?
I know.
But there is no such thing as global warming.
The tornadoes that rolled through here Monday were the one that went through Hazelcrest. It went through, and when you look at the meteorologist's, I guess, layout of the travel of the tornadoes, so it goes through Hazelcrest, it turns around and comes back through Hazelcrest.
And when does that happen?
Over 100 mile an hour winds. And I'm thinking as I'm reading this, an E1 sounds, if it's 100 miles an hour or more and it's only an E1, I'm like, it doesn't seem appropriate. Or an E0, well, that means it's 80 to 90 mile an hour winds. That doesn't seem scary enough. You know, my world, it needs to be scarier than that. But it was, and people are still cleaning up and, you know, trying to put the pieces together after that.
Oops. Speaking of clean, he heard us say cleaning up.
Yes.
And Big Bob, Big Plug Bob, has hopped on his Zamboni. The blue lights are starting to flash. Oh, here he comes.
Sorry, Bob. We're not done with the show yet, Bob.
If you would like to be our last call, 312-981-7200. Is the number to call. That number again is 312-981-7200. And as long as you haven't won anything from this here radio place within the last 2 months or 60 days, whichever comes first. By the way, did we say rabbit, rabbit, rabbit?
It doesn't matter now. We posted as of midnight, rabbit, rabbit, rabbit.
Okay.
Well, Jonathan's new here. Do you know what rabbit, rabbit, rabbit's all about?
I've only heard that sitting around a bonfire. Is that... And I swear,
and what were you told sitting around that bonfire?
Yes, really. Like you were you roasting
smoke,
a rabbit?
When the wind would shift the smoke of the bonfire, like, you know, it would be uncomfortable.
Oh.
So then I knew a girl who would say rabbits, 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 and I had no idea what that meant.
Oh, that's interesting.
I was in my teens when, like, I used to have bonfires at my house, and then she would I always thought it had to do with getting the smoke to blow the other way.
No. Just, you need to know the tradition from WGN Radio, and this goes back forever. This is a tradition. On the first of each month, you have to say rabbit, rabbit, rabbit if you want good luck to come your way.
Right.
So it became a tradition that we upheld from the Wally Phillips show because Wally started this. He heard that there were some French kids that did this at the first of the month. And he thought that was a wonderful idea so people would hurt themselves to get to the phone to Rabbit, Rabbit, Rabbit Wally so that they could win a Seymour Paisin scarf or a ladybug pendant watch. And then when Wally was no longer doing the morning show and we were on the air as of the start of the first of the month, so as of midnight o'clock, we would say Rabbit, 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 or a listener would beat us to it. And so we have upheld that tradition on our Facebook pages. And so
because we have our priorities.
We do. These are the important things. Tradition is a fine thing.
As long as it doesn't become a habit.
As your dad always said, tradition is a fine thing as long as it does not become a habit. Remember that, kids.
So we're going to try and find a last caller. The lines are jamming up already. So 312-981-7200, and We'll take a break and find out who's our last caller. So stay with us.
Yep. Closing time.
Yeah, you really kind of do. Nope. Can't
stand. No, you can't.
In fact, you can't hear the rest of the song.
We have to get out of here because we're catching a plane.
We are heading on a Big Bird Sunday. We're heading out to Pasadena to hang out with our grandson Joseph and his posse.
Oh, the heck with them. We're going to hang out with Joseph.
We will be back here live next Sunday or Saturday, whichever comes first.
Unless we melt.
And one of the people that we're going to be talking with, we haven't talked to Jessica Radloff for a while.
She's been a busy, busy woman. Yeah. She's been on TV a lot, doing Entertainment Tonight. She's
the author of the Big Bang Theory book, wonderful book. And also, then Joseph's dad, Patrick, is going to join us. And, oh, no, we can't say anything because we haven't locked that in yet.
The other thing is secret. Top secret, but be here.
So it's a full show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to get Patrick's technology notes from last week.
Don't tell him. Because he works really hard on those notes just so we can post them for the audience. And then drop them
They may not get posted. We were doing other things.
I know.
I'll give you a...
Drop this, right?
Right.
All right.
Because we had a lot of posts last week, too.
We did, yes. And we covered a lot of good ground, too.
Yeah.
As I say, he puts a lot of thought into what we need to know in the world of technology.
Okay.
You chose last week because it was your birthday, so I'm going to choose this week, and I'm going to go with number two. Number two is our last caller tonight.
And number two would be Bob. Hey, Bob, you're on WGN. Where are you calling from?
Hello, Bob.
Crystal Lake, hello.
Crystal Lake, and you sound like your phone is cutting out.
You okay?
Crystal Lake, can you hear me?
Yeah. You're kind of dropping out on us.
Yeah.
Stay right where you are. Don't move, okay, so we can chat.
Yes.
Okay.
What are you doing up at this hour of the morning?
Well, I'm actually the liturgist for my church service tomorrow morning, and I was just practicing Matthew chapter 14, 13 through 21.
Well, I'm honored that you would have us on in the background.
Yeah, listening to us in the background while you're working on the liturgy? Good heavens,
yes.
or good Lord.
Good man.
Yes.
So is this something you do every Sunday?
No, it's just, they choose the different liturgists. You know, you sign up if you want to be the liturgist. Because a lot of people are uncomfortable.
Sure.
You know, getting up in front of a congregation.
Sure.
And reciting, it's not reciting, I'm just reading it. So,
So are you going to do a dramatic reading of Matthew?
Not too dramatic. And I'm just reading it for the first time right now. So, anyway, yeah.
Well, I don't think I've ever thought about what it takes to be a liturgist. I don't think I've ever used that word. And I'm Baptist, so go figure. I don't think we had liturgists in our church.
And I have to ask, if you're the liturgist, do you ever sometimes deal with what everybody else sitting in the pews is dealing with? There's something about being in church, especially on a hot day, and you start to get dopey. And do you ever do that before? And you're, oh, I have to stay awake because I have to go up into this important stuff. I got to do this. And you don't want to nod off.
Actually, that's when you pray. That's when prayer comes in handy. You say, please, Lord, let me get up there and look like I know what I'm talking about.
Bob, I will share with you the best sermon I ever heard, and it stays with me to this day. It was at St. Felicitas Church on the south side of Chicago, just after they had constructed. They used to have a small church. Then they had constructed this new church. The church was so new, they didn't have air conditioning put in it yet. And it was a hot, hot day, like a 97-degree day. And the priest comes up, and he's ready to give his sermon, and he just looks around, and he says, "You realize how hot it is right here, right now? Imagine how hot it is in hell." And that was his sermon. He walked, that was
go
it.
Go home. And it was, that's yeah,
and I loved
there,
it.
Yeah, you're sitting there sweating going, oh, okay, yeah.
He made his point.
Yes. You want to give your church a shout-out, Bob?
Yes, it's First Congregational Church of Crystal Lake.
All right. Church. Yeah. So now when people walk up to you and say, I heard you on the radio last night, you go, yep, that was me, for sure. Do you often tune in on Saturday nights, or did you just stumble by us tonight?
No, I enjoy listening. I usually will turn on the radio, you know, maybe around midnight or so as I'm getting, you know, getting ready to go to bed. I'm kind of a night owl.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I always love to hear the guy sing the song about, you don't have to go home.
Okay, and being a liturgist, I will ask, have you ever gone to YouTube to hear the rest of that song?
I have not.
Don't.
And
don't.
Tonight.
Don't.
So
don't.
If you ever do, you will understand why we will never play the rest of that song on the radio.
Or, Bob, as we say, if you ever hear the rest of that song, you know that that's it for our radio career. We ain't doing any more radio ever, ever, ever. And if you listen to the song, folks will understand why. It's our swan song. Well, after church, are you going to go out to eat? Are you going to come home to a good meal? What's the Sunday look like?
Well, yeah, I'm gonna go for a walk before church. Mm-hmm. I usually walk about 2 miles a day, and
ooh,
just
good
know,
for you.
Yeah,
it's a good thing to do, and I'm looking forward to playing some tennis on Monday morning.
Ooh,
and then getting back to work. And I'll work most of the afternoon tomorrow too, so
wow.
I've got a lot to catch up on.
Bob, you sound like a disgustingly healthy guy.
I know. We're not worthy, Bob. I'm feeling fat and sassy just sitting here talking to you.
But now I have to ask, that there has to be some sort of a Sunday dinner, Sunday snack or something that you're looking forward to. What would that be?
Well, we actually had a special dinner tonight because my son and his wife and two kids just got back from a week up in Traverse City, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So we had them over. It's always nice to have family when they come back from a vacation. You get to hear the fresh tales of, mm-hmm. of what they did their trip, and it's always nice. It's kind of a tradition that my mom used to do. My wife and I go on vacation with our three kids, and whenever we came back, she'd always have a nice dinner prepared for us.
That's good.
And I think they like to hear the stories of our vacation.
Plus, you come back from vacation and you're trying to get adjusted to the fact that you have to do things like cook a meal, but to have somebody else do it for you kind of extends the vacation. I love that. Well, Bob, it is nice to meet you. Gangbusters tomorrow at church,
yeah.
with Matthew. And we are going to send you out an official WGN Radio t-shirt. We'll be proud to see you wearing that.
And if you get a chance,
I'll to my wife, because I happened to be wearing one today.
Oh.
I wore one today, and everybody said, that's a great color on you, Bob.
Well, good.
Great.
Well, hang on for a second. Jonathan will get some info from you off the air, and have a good Sunday. That's all we can ask for.
Yeah.
Because weather's supposed to be pretty good around here. No rain.
I don't know that we're worthy of being. I mean, they're working on the liturgy, and they've got us.
In the background.
In the background.
And thank goodness we didn't play Stroken. I'm glad we didn't go there with Bob listening.
And we almost did.
We almost did. I said no.
Yep.
I told you guys no, no.
Jonathan and I were voting yes. And
I said
you
no.
You said no.
However.
However.
The White Sox are playing next Saturday against the Guardians. It's a night game, so we should be in the studio right as that game wraps up. So
yes.
If they end up being a 15-2 win,
yes.
I can't make any promises. Yeah. We won't play it.
Yep.
Yeah. You know what? I'm with you then. Yep. All the way.
That works for me.
Well, our thanks to Jonathan and to Big Plug Bob and Ron and Dimitri and to you guys for tuning in. We hope that you will be here next Saturday night. And we have a whole bunch of things planned. Yes, we're going to be in California all week, but we're going to be back Saturday for the show.
With a full show. Be here at 9 o'clock next Saturday night, or we'll talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good week.